The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red. For the last time this season, the lights change.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When we never said start.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 301 for Wednesday, the 11th of January, 2012. And welcome to 2012. My name is Jim Race. I am here with Jules Chisek down in the Bay Area. And really looking forward to this show, Jules.
Yeah. We're back.
We are back.
And with that...
Oh, you bastard. I don't have an unopened one handy. Wait, pause. I'm thrilled. And you know, Jules, that I've been kind of bouncing off the walls to try and get this show out because we've got some amazing interviews for this show. And it's going to be another long one.
It's going to be another long one. And actually, just so everybody knows, Jim had these interviews and he had them ready last week, but we've decided to wait until we're really ready to go because, as we said, we wanted to take some time off, get back into character so we can start going out weekly again.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the plan from this point forward, is to get back on our regular Motopod schedule of weekly stuff. Whether or not we find something really good to talk about, that might be a different story, but... in the meantime, three interviews and a bunch of good content for you guys tonight. James Whittam, who is always very popular on the show, about 45 minutes with him. Brilliant. Kind of fills us in on the end of BSB. 50 minutes, nearly an hour with one Ben Spies. And the one that kind of blew me away, Jules, and I'm still kind of reeling from it, is the interview that I did with Dr. Costa of the Clinica Mobile. You've heard it.
Yeah. And, we've been trying to get him on the show for years and years and years. And he does speak English, but he doesn't like to speak English, I guess. So Jim actually managed to hook up with him and a gentleman that translates all of Dr. Costa's books. And he acted as the interpreter. So it's an interesting interview. We've never tried this before.
I know. I going into it, I didn't know that was going to be the situation. So I'm not sure if you caught it, Jules, and I'm sure the listeners will, though. I had to shift gears so fast.
Yeah. No, I totally did. And also, didn't you have to start like earlier or something like that?
That's right. It was an hour earlier than I thought it was going to be. And so the audio on that one isn't perfect, but Jules, I know you'll do your magic as you always do and make it sound as good as possible.
We'll see. Now you put me on the spot. No, it sounds great. Sounds great. The one that is a little bit iffy is the James Whittam one, but the content is so good that I think that after the first few minute or so, you guys will not mind the quality.
Yeah, exactly. And we're getting this down. You know, we had same thing that you guys kind of have over your own Christmas holidays, is we don't always quite get things right off the bat. And so I've been bouncing around between locations, so I wasn't quite prepared for some of this stuff, but in the meantime, we're going to be getting back to standard Motopod fare. We've got some great interviews coming up that I'm not going to mention, Jules. but we've got some cool stuff coming up. I do want to say thank you to a whole bunch of people and a bunch of folks sending some donations over the holidays. Name checks, Michael Hansen, Bob McCullough, Carl Marsh, Stephen Singleton, Paul Harris, Peter Newell and Lee Allen. Massive thanks. And, you know,
some of these names you hear over and over when you're doing this. So they've been, you know, it's amazing how many times donated to the cause. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, and to be frank, it's kind of important because this stuff, as you well know, Jules, and you and I were talking earlier today, it isn't free.
No, in fact, I just wanted to say that we, the, for the six winners of the calendars from Show 300. Those are in the mail.
Yeah.
And it just kind of like made me realize, you know, every time we do this kind of thing, it's like, you know, sending this stuff all over the world does cost money. So
yeah. So if you would like to donate to the show, and we totally appreciate it, you can do it through the Facebook fan page or directly through motopodcast.com, and it would be much appreciated. And maybe at some point, Jules, we'll put together some sort of subscription thing. I don't know. In the meantime,
been suggested.
Yeah. In the meantime.
And you know, just as a teaser, we do have another contest to kick the year off, but we're not going to tell you what it is. You have to listen to the end of the show, and it'll be worth it. Believe me. Jim set this one up, and it's definitely a good one.
You're a bad man. what should we do? Should we dive into the listener feedback?
Yes. Yes. We had some great emails from Douglas Edmiston. I'm going to tackle the first one, the reading of the first one. The second one is just... Jim's going to have to do that one. All right. So this is in response to last episode's your interview with Mark Miller. So Douglas Edmiston writes, Dennis Noyes posted this on Twitter a few days ago, and I'm sure Mark will eventually warm up to CRT once it's all going on. And this is what Dennis Noyes tweeted. Best thing about CRT is that we will talk about valve angles, squish, valve float, and all that other forgotten stuff in the era of leased bikes. And Douglas goes on and says, I think everyone keeps forgetting that while the rules may be allowing production-derived engines, that they don't have the production engines internally, just like the Blada WCM project. With top bosses at HRC, Yamaha, and Ducati saying they won't ever claim an engine, if that's not some trick to get people to pump a lot of money into engines, we may see some teams with some really nice engines that we all get to talk about. Gresini's CRT project, for example. I don't think there's a chance in hell they're going to keep the 76mm times 55.1mm bore and stroke that the CBR1000RR currently has, especially when the rules allow them to an 81mm bore. That's a massive difference there.
Absolutely.
Yep. He goes on, I just can't see the current specs of that engine being competitive, even the CRT field with the Aprilia and BMW engines, unless Forward Racing sticks with the Bosch electronics that seem to suck. CRT will still be just as much a prototype as what HRC, Yamaha, and Ducati come up with. Hell, I have the same start-stop switch and grips on my 600RR that HRC puts on their RC213V, so not even the real prototypes are 100% prototype. The racing will still be just as good, even if it is dumbing down MotoGP a little right now. Better to have the sport be dumbed down than continue on its path and no longer having it around in 2 or 3 years.
You know, this almost harkens back to that one email that I sent about prototype bikes and how, you know, parts are parts. And it's going to be interesting, you know, and you'll certainly hear a little bit of talk about this in the conversation that I have with Ben Spies, to see what stuff comes forward. You know, I'm thrilled.
You know, that's the thing that struck me the most about this email. It's I mean, he makes really good points, especially about the stroke, you know.
Yeah.
But it's also there's been a turnaround in a lot of the fans. You're starting to notice a shift where people are starting to get really excited about the idea. They're starting to kind of get it, like, you know, there's going to be more privateer type of efforts. There's going to be a lot more different kinds of innovation, not just big money innovation, you know, big R&D innovation, but just really crazy ideas being tried, and some of them failing, most of them failing probably. Every once in a while, we're going to get, you know, something really amazing happen. So yeah.
Well, and it's going to, I'm actually really looking forward to seeing the Kawasaki ZX10 engine in that kind of race trim with whatever, I forget the name of the team that's running it, but that should be fun. You remember how badly you and I were gnashing our teeth at the beginning when they were talking about going from 250 GP to Moto 2. I mean, really, both of us, we are kind of purists at heart, but you have to accept what's coming, right?
Absolutely. You know, and I still have reservations about Moto 2 because I think that it's a little too dumbed down. And sometimes the racing can be a kind of a crapshoot. But But we've had an incredible season this year. We had a great season last year, but this, I mean, in 2010, in 2011, though, it was an incredible season, and this was really the season that sold me on, let's try this stuff. You know, I'm really looking to Moto 3, for example, even though, you know, we're all going to miss the two strokes, but hell, you know, we got to make some progress too.
Well, I think Moto 2 paved the way for Moto 3, to be frank.
Oh yeah.
And so you've seen what's been a somewhat successful formula. And the nice thing about Moto 3 is that there's a lot more open range for teams to do stuff that's a little bit crazy. We're going to have a whole bunch of different manufacturers in there. And it's like, okay, wait, now that literally, Jules, that's our new prototype class.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have obviously the factory teams in MotoGP be the ultimate prototypes, but that's an entire prototype class, the Moto 3 thing.
Yep.
And you know, I warmed up to the CRT idea a lot faster than to the 800s because, frankly, I never really did warm up to the 800s.
Yeah. Well, you look back at the 990s now with fondness, don't you?
Yeah. Totally. No. Absolutely. No. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Should I carry on?
Yeah. Good luck.
All right. I'm going to keep going. And then, as you said, Jules, another really good one from Douglas. Okay. And we're on the same point here. Oh, and some more talking points about the rule changes as Paletta is putting into place, if you're interested, mostly about the new minimum weight increase and talks of a control ECU from 2013 on. With the switch to the new format in 2012, which teams and factories have known about since the Indy round in 2009, they've already basically developed their bikes about this loose set of rules and are known now refining them for the actual rules in 2012. Rather than dropping a bombshell on the teams and factories by adding new regulations that fix the problem with MotoGP, that being the electronics, which I'm not sure I agree about, he's attacking the actual problem slowly, that being the fuel capacity. And Jules, you know I've always argued for this.
Give
him more fuel.
Yep.
Carrying on. Giving CRT the ability to have more fuel to keep them somewhat competitive without the need for all of the electronics was just the first step. Let the factories see that you don't need all of these fancy electronics that HRC keeps trying to justify. Interesting. Next was throwing in the idea of a possible control ECU, which would pose some problems for teams on prototype machines with the current 21-liter fuel capacity, even pass minimum weight check while still being able to run. Take away their ability to control the throttle by the ECU on corner entry, anti-wheelie, the lap-by-lap, corner-by-corner, fuel mapping, etc., that makes their job of having enough fuel to finish the races even more difficult. I will argue, Jules, that dumbing down the tires might be a thought, but then again, that will come.
Let's talk about that when you're done.
Okay. Add on to that now the heavier minimum weight limit, and we might actually see a bike or two run out of fuel before the end of the race come next season, which we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, they could just lean out the bikes even more, but they've got to keep them running pretty damn lean already. And when you throw in the fact that they have to make their engines last due to having, only having six for the year, and now harsher penalties if you go over that limit. This is very specifically, I will point out, to the factory bikes, not for CRT.
Right.
That's for me. It's got to be pretty damn difficult now. This is still coming from Douglas. He's turning into the Martin Darlington of email writers. Shall I carry on?
Go.
All right. I know some people only think of traction control when they hear the term electronics. So I'm mostly surprised to see that it's more of team mechanics who are assuming electronics only means TC. Some even claiming on Twitter, and there are a lot of people on Twitter, Jules, you know as well as I do, that if you take away the electronics, you take away the safety of riders. Stoner does a really good job of explaining what the real safety issue is in his interview with Moto Matters recently. I guess I better go read that, right?
Oh, it's an excellent interview.
Okay. Anyway, I think as Paletta is basically trying to slowly force the MSMA, that being, Jules, as you well know, the Manufacturers Association, to not only agree to, but to ask for an increase in the fuel capacity. With a mechanical rev limit due to the 81-millimeter bore now in place, fuel consumption should still be near the same as the 800cc bikes. So even as tiny as a 1 liter fuel increase can make a pretty substantial difference in the bike's reliance on electronics to finish the races. It'll also be cheaper to slowly put new changes into place that factories and teams can incorporate into normal development of the bikes rather than dropping a bomb on them and make them all of a sudden develop a brand new bike 1 year after having developed one of the new format, that being the, you know, the thousands. We've already been seeing, you know, Ducati struggling with that big time, and their GP12 was built and developed in 2010 and not 2011, like some people think and want to say. Rossi, Burgess, and crew lost their touch. Interesting. I haven't read this, so this is all fresh to me. All just a theory from what I'm assuming, and I could very well be wrong, but I'm waiting to hear about a new rule change for 2013 that calls for a mechanical link between the throttle and the throttle bodies. If that ever comes along, I think it'll be pretty clear what Ezpeleta is doing. A mechanical linkage between the throttle and throttle bodies would say goodbye to fly-by-wire, and they can even claim it as a safety concern after Pedrosa's mishap at Motegi. And I think he had another one at Sachsenring, if I remember correctly. That was the one in the rain. And without fly-by-wire, the teams lose the ability to control the throttle on corner entry and put it back into the hands of the riders and make them have to deal with the engine braking and throttle control. Though that would not only solve the electronics and fuel issues, but it'll make then Moto2 an even better proving ground for MotoGP, as if there's one main skill that that class can teach. It's controlling the throttle on corner entry. Very, very
interesting
great set of stuff.
So I don't think we can go back and to a direct linkage. I don't think that's going to happen because there's way too much investment. The MSMA would probably just drop out if they couldn't run a little bit of that fly by wire in between the wrist and the engine bodies. And frankly, you know, this is what we're riding on. So
yeah, I agree. I mean, it's really hard to take a step back, much like you say, because motorcycle racing and prototype racing at the highest level of GP is all about moving forward, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you dumb things down? And so I mentioned when we were talking in there, I'm like, you know, can you give the tires less grip? Well, I don't know, you know, because we're trying to make everything work better, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, and better for a good race is different than better for the world, like as that uses the damn thing, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, Bridgestone's not going to spend all this R&D to make that a tire that's perfect for racing, and then I mean that's because it wears perfectly, you know, over 45 minutes, you know, because that's not the business that they're in. However. However, I do think that there is a bit of dumbing down going on that Ezpeleta wants to do, and you know, if this fuel gap between the CRT and the factory bikes remains the same, I have a feeling that by 2013 we're going to see CRTs doing much better, or a major rule change.
And I think I'd agree. I think 2012 is going to be a pair of championships. And I think near the end of the year, we're going to see some very serious surprises. You know, we kind of skated through 2011 with very few rain races, if you think about it.
Yes.
And if we see more of those, which, you know, odds are they're going to happen, we could see some surprises. I will put my foot on the floor and say we will see a CRT bike on the podium before the end of the year.
Wow. But the last time that you said something and I said, wow, you were right. So we'll see.
I'm occasionally right.
That was, I think, like 6 years ago. No.
Just kidding. All right, you ready?
Yeah. There you go.
There you go.
All right. Did you get delivery?
I did.
Nice. Nice.
Thank you. All right.
So excellent email. I did want to mention that Kind of a tangential to this was that Loris Capirossi has been appointed like the safety director for 2012 and possibly beyond. And the first thing he started talking about was the tires.
Yeah,
and,
but you know, I think a lot.
He was coming in from like, I just got off the bike. I just had a shitty championship. I will, you know, whine.
I think a lot of people misinterpreted what he was saying. And it wasn't hard because it was, you know, basically translated from Italian through,
right.
You know, and it was on Crash, right? So, I don't think that he was being as harsh on Bridgestone as a lot of people thought that he was being. I think he was basically just saying, you know, okay, the tires need to be the same. But I think the point that he was trying to make was saying, okay, I'm going to be the guy that picks the compounds. That was the key part that I got out of that story.
Right.
I'm going to be the guy that picks the compounds next year for each race meeting, because that's someplace where the tire companies have traditionally fallen down in the past.
Which is actually, I think, a great idea to have a guy who's, you know, I mean, not only has he an incredibly long career, but he just got off those bikes, got off those tires, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Of course, he's going to piss somebody off at Bridgestone right off the bat. Which was interesting. You know, you and I were exchanging some emails today. Tom Tremaine is no longer the Bridgestone press officer. There's a new young lady. Tom has moved on to new pastures, and thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Oh. Yep.
Tom's always been a great guy, a good guy to the show. Should we roll an interview, you think?
We got this last email from Cameron Satinfield.
Okay.
He says, I'm relatively new, but a ravenous fan when it comes to MotoGP, so I'll apologize in advance if I'm missing the obvious. I haven't really heard anyone discuss how little sense it made that Suzuki left the paddock after the first test numbers came out in November. With the Moto2 bikes running faster lap times than the CRTs, I suppose, the first thing that came to my mind was just how competitive Suzuki could be in just campaigning the 800 again if times were too tight to develop a leader bike.
Right.
That 800 had gained some serious ground by the end of the season. With larger 2012 fields, the lion's share of which I think the 800cc Suzuki under Bautista could take, it seems that now Suzuki would be even get even more press for the racing dollar this year by staying higher up in the numbers on a longer ladder. With more new teams out there to absorb the Rizla squad, the Suzuki's return seems unlikely. To abandon the ship just when things were getting very promising for them seems to speak of larger financial problems within the company. What do you guys think? So, I mean, I think that unfortunately, Suzuki wasn't like a sporting decision. You know, this was a, you know,
pure financial.
Yes, yeah, so some board meeting, and they, you know, they looked at some numbers and said no.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really sad. Because it's totally true, and that's why those guys kept going, you know, with the tests, because the team, the Suzuki team, absolutely wanted to see this happen, and they were basically playing to the very end with the hope that the suits were going to come up with something and let him race next year. Because I think Cameron, you're absolutely right that. They came up with something at the end of the season. Bautista was really getting comfy with that bike, doing really good, getting good results, and they would not have been at the low end next year.
Yeah,
with that bike.
Honestly and personally, for me, I think I need to get this off my chest. I need to knock Suzuki corporate because they put those guys on the fence for way too long.
Oh my god! And because they kept promising.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, I think it basically came down to kind of a an ultimatum from Espoleta saying, look, if you don't make a decision, we're going to fine you or something, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. And great, you're going to be back in, you say you're going to be back in 2013, 2014, whatever. But they fucked a bunch of people over.
Basically, yeah. No need to mince words.
Yeah, sorry. Was that my out loud voice? but I'm in the same vein, Jules, I'm very proud and excited to see what that same squad, the Crescent Suzuki boys, do in World Superbike, because I have a feeling they're just going to kick all sorts of ass. I think that's going to be a great fucking team.
It's going to be amazing. They have so much focus and so much motivation and great riders. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. So I'm really, really looking forward to that. Thanks for that, Cameron. It's definitely one of those things that kind of you set my teeth on edge, but in a good way, because it was something that I needed to say.
Cool.
All right. What do we do now, Jules?
Let's just, there has been other news, the Vroom event, Ducati, blah, blah, blah. Go read about it on the MotoGP.com. This is Motopod. You get to listen to some great interviews now. So let's just go right into that.
All right. Zoom, zoom.
All right. We're going to start with James.
Fire up with James.
Cool.
All right, Jim Race here with one James Whitteman. It's been far, far too long, sir. Good to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, cheers, Jimmy. It's good to be back. Yeah, I'm doing good. I've just had a really good Christmas. I've been out doing a few local trials events, and I've got myself a twin shock Evo bike and a TZ. I'm going to do a little bit of racing this next year, both off-road and a little bit of road racing, because I've had that, that kind of little bell in the back of your head that says you're getting too old for all this shit and you need to do stuff before, in the next 10 years. So, I'm going to do a bit of racing this year.
That is funny, because I've been I love the fact that you say that, because I've been thinking the exact same thing lately. It's been, for me, 3 years off of the track, and I've got that itch that you cannot scratch any other way but getting yourself back on a bike and going up and tearing yourself up. But I have to ask, you got a trial? I cannot see you as a trials bike rider, mate.
No, to be quite honest, you're dead right. I love the trials. I've got a nice bike. I've got a bunch of mates who go out all the time. And trials riding's really big in the north of England. We've got lots of kind of boggy kind of woodland bits and lots of terrain. It's traditionally a trials area is in North England that produces some really good riders, Lampkins, Rathmulls, etc. But I'm not one of them. You're dead right. It's my weakest discipline, shall we say.
So I take it you've tapped your foot down fair enough, and you've been out with the Laverty brothers, because I know they get into more mischief than just about anybody else when it comes to a trials bike.
But I'd say that again. It's a bit of a bad line this year.
Have you been out with the Laverty brothers? Because I know that those boys know how to get into more mischief on a trials bike than just about anybody.
Do you know what? All the modern crop of British-based road racers are well into the trials, which is what's got me back into it. I did some back in the day. But the Haslams, they're into the trials riding. They're all into it. The Laverty's, everybody has a trials bike. Leon Cammy is reasonably good. And I do get them guys up here. Occasionally, but they're very good, and I'm not that good.
I like that. You're going to leave it at that. So, you've had a busy year, obviously, and you've kind of got your opportunity now. You've still been out flying, but the weather over there is kind of a bit of a mess, isn't it?
No, it's not been. To be honest, as far as private flying goes, I do like me flying. It's not been a brilliant year, but it's been all right. It's not been so bad. I've managed to fly myself to at least 5 of the BSB meetings and the Isle of Man. So, yeah, it can't have been that bad, because I'm a fairly basically qualified pilot in that I can't fly in bad weather. It must have been not a bad year for flying, because I managed to get myself to 5 or 6 meetings.
No, okay, so I'm gonna pin you down right here, because I am coming back over to the Isle next year, and I really don't want to go on Flybe. Do you think I might be able to hitch a ride with you?
Yeah, I tell you what, you're a tall bloke, you, and whether you'd fit in my aeroplane, I'm not so sure. But I've got to say, the only way for me to get to Isle of Man is to fly yourself. It's really easy. From Huddersfield, where I fly from, I've got my own grass strip, my own little it's a field with the walls taken out, really. So I fly from my own place, and it's 40 minutes to the Isle of Man, which, yourself, if I'd got to get in a car, drive to the ferry terminal, get on a ferry, not only does it cost a lot, but also it's a full day, maybe a day and a half just to get there. So flying for me is the way forward. And flying with a cheaper airline, it's never a good thing, is it? Mind you, you might think it's all right when you flown with me next year.
You know what? I will do that. And listeners out there, you got to pin James down to this as well. So Your focus this last season, and we haven't talked in ages, and one of the things that I really do want to talk about is, frankly, the way that the BSB Championship panned out this year, because it kind of, you know, bibbed and bobbed along, and in the end, we had a screamer and one that probably was, in my recent memory, one of the best national championship finals in probably the last 20 years.
Exactly that. I've never seen a better race, in actual fact. Obviously, I've seen bigger races with more at stake, as in world championship races, but I've never seen a race that had as much excitement in it, really. And a lot riding on it for the boys, you know. I mean, Hopkins really surprised me and impressed me with the way he's tackled BSB this year. You just had to question whether... We all know his background, he's had his issues, his raw talent's not in question, but just how well he was going to go and get to grips with, or be prepared to get to grips with, say, right, Cadwell Park or, you know, Knock Hill, was in question. I knew he'd go good at places like, you know, Brands and Silverstone and Donington, because they're the big, wide-open places where, you know, his sort of GP experience is going to show. But I just thought he'd get to Cadwell and think, oh, no chance. But he didn't. He went there, he went to Alton, Cadwell, all the rest of them. He dug in and he tried and he was really impressive. And the way it boiled up with him and Tommy Hill towards the end of the season was fantastic. Now, I don't know that your listeners know, but a couple of years ago, BSB changed its points scoring system,
sure,
from a straight 15 down, like is the norm, to those. The points was the same. 15 down was the points, but instead of that going through the whole season to decide a champion, they had the first 9 of 12 was just to fettle out the top 6. And once you got locked into that top 6 in the last 3 rounds, it was only the top 6, called the title fighters, a bit of a cheesy name, but who could shoot for the championship. And thereby, they start from an equal amount of points after the 9 rounds and going to the last 3 on equal points. So basically, it was done to stop people, a single rider running away with the championship and winning it 4 rounds to go, as done by Cameo a few years
ago.
Right. And it works. I mean, whether you're a fan of the system or not, as an ex-rider, I tend to like the idea that if you have a good start to the season and you get going early and you can build up a cushion, well, you deserve the cushion. This system doesn't work like that, but whether you're a fan of the system or not, it did make for a fantastic last couple of 3 rounds. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a massive amount of Motopod listeners that participated this year in the MCN Fantasy League, which requires you to choose a British a pair of British riders. And so we're well conversed in the 3-round shootout, as they call it, or maybe that's what they call it here in the States. The addition of the more stockish bikes in there kind of threw a loop into the thing in the end. But and then as a rider myself, I look at that and I'm like, okay, well, because you do get to throw out a single worst round. Is that not correct?
Yeah, you could throw out a single worst round, but in actual fact, they've worked before they got this system in. They retrospectively implemented the system going back about 4 years and seeing what would have happened if it had happened in previous years. And what it would have done, they reckoned, I've never worked it out myself, but the organisers, before implementing it, reckoned that they've gone back 5 years and it wouldn't have made any... The champion would have been the same champion, except you only would have won it in the last round, which they thought, that's perfect. In actual fact, if you add it up this year with the old system, it would have been Shaky Byrne that would have won the championship. So in that respect, it's a little bit... You've got to think that it's a little bit unfair. But having said that, they all start the season with the knowledge that that's how the point system work, and you play your hands accordingly, you know. So maybe Hopkins could have done different things, you know. I know that certainly certain riders freewheeled a little bit, used a bit of the last part of the main championship before the cutoff as testing. They tried swing arms, all sorts of stuff. So whether it would have worked out different, I don't know. But certainly when you start a season, you know what how the points scoring works, and you ride accordingly. And there's no point complaining afterwards because you're already in it. You know, it's like when it went from 25 points down, you know, 25 points for a win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no point after the season's finished saying, well, you know, when it's been changed to 15 points for a win, if you, you know, well, I would need 25 points for a win because I would have won it then. It doesn't work like that. You know that the points are the points and the system's the system. So, I mean, everybody knew. And for me, it kind of worked this year. It was fantastic.
Yep, I think it was fun. What are your thoughts on next year and kind of going to an all Evo sort of thing in BSB? I understand why they're doing it. I understand that the economy certainly has a piece to play in it. And you see the same thing happening in MotoGP to some degree, trying to lessen the expense and say, and World Superbike as well, you know, single bikes, but. How do you think that's going to work out? I think BSB was probably smart to kind of pre-implement it by running the class this year and the year before.
Absolutely. I think they've done probably the right thing. I mean, we're not in a good position now financially, and, you know, none of us wants to curb power. None of us wants to see the end of the prototype. MotoGP bikes. None of us want to see that. But by the same token, none of us want to sit and watch MotoGP on a Sunday and see sort of 15, 14, 13 bikes on the grid, you know? So
right.
Something has to be done. And I think the BSB organisers have felt that they'd be better doing it sooner rather than later. I've looked at the rules in depth and I think they're very, very well thought out. Now, one of the things they have done is allowed a certain amount of tuning instead of running stock engines, which they get away with. I mean, I don't care whether you're watching a race and they're doing a 2-minute 2-second lap or a 2-minute 4-second lap. You cannot tell 1.5 to 2 seconds a lap as you sit on the side of the track if you don't have a stopwatch on them. Yeah. You watch the racing, and the racing's the main thing. If it's exciting, it's exciting. Having said that, to run stock engines totally, would mean that every time a brand new bike came out, well, there was technically an advancement on everything that's gone before, which does happen.
True.
Well, that particular bike would have a massive advantage, and if you weren't on one, you couldn't win. So to get around that, to give what they call parity in the press conference that I sat in at Brands, they said to give parity to every manufacturer and to give an equal chance, they're allowing a certain amount of tuning, but they're not allowing you to go to the lengths that's going to cost you a fortune, or they're not allowing you also to use a lot of lightweight stuff on a shoestring that's going to mean the engines are throwing rods the whole time and breaking pistons and all that kind of thing. And what, for me, is the kind of masterstroke is the controlled ECU. And they haven't used an ECU that's exactly the same for every single bike. What they've done is they've based the ECU on the standard ECU and the parameters that that has. So if your bike revs to 12.5 as its standard road-going rev limit, it's homologated, if you like, rev limit,
yep.
Well, you're allowed 1,000 revs on top of that, and that's all. Whatever your standard homologated road rev limit is, you're allowed 1,000 revs over the top, and that's it. And that's a brilliant thing, because it means there's no point having, you know, altering pistons, rods, and everything to make the thing rev its brains out and go quick and blow its brains out all the time. Because you're not allowed to do that. You'll have 1,000 revs on top of standard. So it's good. I also think that try to do away with all electronics, i.e. no launch control, no traction control, no anti-wheel, and all that kind of thing. For me, that's a really good thing because it's going to be more back to basics. Now, the only problem with that is the fact that people are going to be turning up to watch their races on just about every 1 litre sports bike. That's actually trickier, technically, than what the bikes they're going to watch. But I actually don't think people are going to mind that. As long as you see exciting racing, I think, you know, we're good to go. I think it's going to be really good. And I think something had to be done, and I think it's probably a good move, in my opinion.
You know, it's funny because I've heard the same exact thing you said before. You know, people might be showing up on a little bit trickier bikes because, you know, the guys that are riding on the roads can afford to throw whatever kit they want at it, and that clearly would be outside the rules. But if they decide to go racing with that same bike, they'll find themselves suddenly slammed into a superbike class and be 12 seconds off the pace or even worse. And so the bottom line, James, I think, is that when you can take a stock bike and put somebody like yourself on it, or well, maybe not yourself at our advanced ages, but you know, one of the top blokes that are running in BSP or MotoGP or World Superbike or wherever, and watch them haul that motherfucker around a racetrack, that is good racing. You could do a stock series with the top guys on the planet, and it would be damn good racing.
That's the whole point. You hit the nail on the head there, because it's a race in the Mars. If you get, whatever the rules, if you get the top lads on these things, a stock bike has 200 horse now.
Oh.
So that's plenty. That is plenty. We've seen from Moto2 that 125, 130 is enough for exciting races. So 200 from a stock engine is certainly enough. So for me, it's the racing that counts. The biggest problem they've got is once there's massive amounts of stock racing, like we're talking super stock racing. I don't know what super stock in the States is like, but in Britain, super stock is basically a standard bike. You've got a standard bike, blueprinted engine, stock suspension virtually. You're allowed some suspension upgrades, but you've got to use stock wheel, stock fork external, stock yoke, stock swing arms, etc., etc. Now, once looking at the time, for me, it's a problem when the real good super stock riders lapping within a second and a half of the top superbike riders, maybe 2 seconds, but certainly they'll be lapping quicker than half the superbike field, which will be, for me, it'll sort of devalue the class somehow, and in a way, it'll merge and mix the classes, so it's a little bit more difficult to understand from a, you know, a lesser knowledgeable spectator's point of view, and that's the problem they've got. Once classes become too similar, not distinguishable between one another, well, that could be a problem, because the super stock class is that popular in Britain now. You know, there's 50 riders trying to qualify for every BSB Super Stock 1000 race, and that's a lot of revenue for the organisers, and it's a good popular class and a good feeder class, and they've got to watch that, you know, people don't turn up for a super bike race on a super stock bike and devalue that championship, and then some of the top super stock guys in their race are actually going quicker than most of the superbike guys. It's a bit of a problem. That's, for me, is the biggest problem.
Yeah, it can get muddy. We ended up with at least, at least Alistair Seedley and maybe a couple of other guys on the Evo bikes got on the BSB Superbike podium this year, didn't we?
Yeah, I tell you, for me, Richard's won the Evo Championship, but I've got to be honest, the rider for me, he certainly came through at the end. It was fantastic on an Evo bike. It was Graeme Gowland.
Yeah.
I mean, Gowland, some of the things he was doing on that bike with no electronics, not even a quick bike. It wasn't even a rocket ship with no electronics. It was an averagely, you know, powerful bike. Not that it wasn't that great power wise or speed wise, and it was just turning miracles on it. Really was. And I think Gowland might be one of the guys who's going to, when the playing field's leveled, if you like, next year, it might be his breakthrough year for Gowland next year. I don't think he won the championship, but I honestly think Gowland can run top five or six.
So talk to me about the final race, because that was one that left myself, and you know, I'm here in California, and we don't get BSB, you know that, but we find ways to do it. And the last two races, and this is season wound down, but the last race was one that left me absolutely breathless and left a ton of our fans breathless. Walk me through what walked you up to that. I remember you walking around on the grid beforehand, and you looked nervous walking around on the grid.
Yeah, I was. I could feel for the boys. I mean, going into the last meeting, it was clearly most likely a baby, although on paper, any one of the top five could have, only Chiannari of the top shootout riders couldn't win the championship on paper. But in actual practical purposes, it was going to be between Tommy Hill and John Hopkins. Now, the way it boiled up, he couldn't have worked any better because it looking like Hopkins had the pace. He was good all the way through qualifying, all the way through practice. He looked smooth. He looked cool. He looked unflappable. He was sat in his box with his blooming country music playing, and it just looked like he was a man who was going to take it. And I said that. Tommy looked nervous. He looked like he had a bit of a mountain to climb. But the way, just the way every single race panned out and the way that the weather panned out was just unreal. And it all kind of conspired with Hopkins' bike. Hopkins didn't actually go out in warm, which could definitely have been a kind of a mistake, really, because he didn't go out in warm-up, and then in the, because it was wet and drying out and all that. Then when it started, then it did dry out, but it was typically British kind of cool end of summer weather, autumnal. Sure. It didn't go out in warm-up, didn't think he needed to. The forecast was to be good in the afternoon, didn't think he had anything to benefit. And to be fair, a lot of people had slid off, and it was not just wet and damp, but slippy conditions as well. It was oddball conditions. So he didn't go out, and he saw that as the right move. But then, first lap of the second race on the Sunday morning, the thing stopped.
Yep.
And whether he had to turn, whatever he did, he turned everything off, powered it down, got it going again, and then fought through. But what it meant is...
Let me pause you just for a moment, because there was a listener, and I had a list of questions that I was supposed to ask you, but that Martin was going to ask you. But one listener... I remember wrote in and said that you said in the broadcast that that was normal. And to me, I was like, no, that's not fucking normal. Your bike doesn't just shut off. And so I don't know if you remember saying that in the broadcast.
Yeah, no,
but...
it, well, to be honest, the electronics on the bikes now, several of the systems are different. I know that some of the systems, what you've got to do is, certainly when they've been on the side, and even a lot of stock bikes, you have to pick them up, turn them off, leave them off for 5 or 6 seconds, then turn them back on. But I know from what other riders have told me, when they get a problem, it doesn't just happen when it stops, but they get a problem with maybe the quick shifter or maybe one parameter of the electronics, and the only way to kind of reset it or get rid of it is to turn everything off and turn it back on again in certain situations. And that, to me, looked like what it was doing. I never actually found out... truthfully, what he was doing. And I said, maybe he's turned everything off, or he was certainly faffing about with some electronics and buttons, and whether he was trying to disable a certain part of it to get it going again. But certainly, the bike stopped, and then he got it going by whatever he did. Was the bottom line is, for us, it couldn't have worked any better, because that meant they started the third race and deciding race, not on equal points, but on close enough points so that whoever... you know, went across the line first was the winner. So it was it couldn't have worked any better. It was the best ever into a championship. Now, the sad news really was the fact that they weren't actually dicing for the win. It was, you know, we watched them the whole time, and that was dead right. But, you know, Shaky Burns out front somewhere, flipping, having a really good meeting, and we never saw him.
Yeah, I know. I know that you're a shaky, biased compatriot, as well as I am, from over here on this side of the pond. Just the entire last lap for us there, and for myself as a fan, just as a racing fan, was brilliant.
I'll tell you what, Jim, the last lap... Even starting the last lap, if you watched how long it took Tommy to force his way past James Ellison, who was having a good meeting, by the way, it took a long time for Tommy to get past Ellison, and he weighed it up and he got past. And once Brooks started catching up into the field and got them all geared up, because it looked like Brooks was going to have an effect on it, because Brooks is on his day really quick and he'll have a go and he's not scared. Once Hopkins got going and got up behind, once Hiller started to go and got past Ellison, Hopkins just forced his way wherever he wanted to get past Ellison is where he went through. It was so quick and so determined and looked so settled. Even then, when Hiller passed him, I thought, Hopkins is still going to beat him. He just looks so good. And then Hill forced past him at the back end of the circuit, I think, Westfield, and then between on the little straight between, do they call it Cooper Straight? Then Hopkins straight back at him. And at that point, I thought, Hopkins has got it. And then going down into Dingle Dell, Hill going down there, you cannot pass there. Even, I know from my racing days, and I've asked other riders who were more current, if you're behind a marker on that part of the circuit and you've got pressure from behind, it's difficult to make a pass there. If you have no pressure from behind and you're leading the race, you wait. You don't go past the back marker there. You wait because it's a really difficult place to get past, even a rider who's going 3 seconds lap slower. But to go winging up the inside of somebody who's dead on the ball like John Hopkins, it was an incredible move and definitely what won Hill the championship. I mean, the move into clearways by Hopkins was, he knew he had to do it. And at that point, he went on the inside of Hill. Hill had defended a bit. Hopkins went wide. And that's what, you know, the move that won it for me was definitely the one at Dingle Dell, because that's what put Hopkins under pressure for probably the first time in this. I still think, until that happened, I think Hopkins thought he had it.
You know, I remember asking in the past what your favorite track was, and I think you came up with, it was a German track, was it not?
Yeah, Hockenheim, yeah.
Yeah, but if you had to pick a British track, I think Brands might be one that would sort of just live in your heart.
Yeah, Brands is absolutely brilliant to ride. Brands has its safety issues, better than it used to be. Still got one or two places where you'd really like to see the barriers move back a bit. But it's a fantastic place to ride. It's got lumps, bumps, lots of sort of ups and downs and cambers, brilliant cambers. It's got a little bit, it's more of a kind of natural circuit as opposed to one of these ones that was designed in the last sort of 20 years on a drawing board with a protractor. You know, it's very natural. It's like it's grown out of the hillside, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Very much on a par with Cadwell and Oulton Park in that respect.
I do. My home circuit is, you may have heard of it as Sears Point, now called Infineon, and it's just carved out of a pair of hillsides. And it, too, has had its safety issues in the past and have been taken care of to much regard over about the last probably 10 years. But it is one of those circuits you never get a chance to rest on. There's no opportunity, even on a small bike.
Yeah, just like Brands, actually. I mean, Brands, particularly Cadwell, are the two circuits where now, when you've got sort of 190, 200 horsepower, even on a stock bike, I mean, I do a lot of instructing around all these circuits, typically on a 1 litre sports bike, fairly stock, and even with a stock 1000 bike now, not, you know, one that's got 220 brake horse in BSB, you just haven't got any time to relax. I remember last racing at Cadwell Park on a 750cc Superbike 4 with perhaps 150 brake, 155. Yep. And you still had a little bit of a rest down the start and finish straight, a little bit of a rest down the back straight, a little bit of time to think what you were doing. You could release your grip on the bars. Now, no chance. Mm-hmm. By the time you go out of Charlie's from the top straight, or the back straight as it's called, and by the time you stop the thing wheeling, because you're going downhill and it starts to take off over the crest, by the time you stopped it wheeling and then go over the other side of the flipping valley, you're trying to stop it. You're either wheeling and clinging onto it for grim death, or you're trying to get the thing stopped. You know, there's no rest at all.
You know, I don't know if you've ever done the same thing that I have, and I have made this mistake at least twice in my life, and I will happily admit to it. But when I was leading a student and had one of those in my mind, so watch this moments where I'm going to show you what to do, which is where what you really shouldn't do. The back wheel comes off the ground, or at least one case, I pitch myself down the road at about 90 miles an hour because I locked the front tire up, unbeknownst to me, going into turn 7 at Sears Point. Not a great way to instruct, is it, James?
Well, I've got to be honest. I've been lucky enough. I've done lots of instructing. I've been lucky enough not to actually fall off when I've been instructing. I tell you what, I have seen a couple of crashes. Most, I've not lost that many, to be honest. But one guy, unluckily, we turned up at Cadwell Park. This was just this year. We turned up at Cadwell Park, and they had a ZX-10 that had an issue, and I couldn't ride it. That was my normal instructor bike. And they had one of the rental bikes I had to do the instructing on that day, which was the only one they had left that wasn't on rent, was an 848 Ducati, rather tired, and you know them things. They're lovely, but a little bit slow. And I thought, well, I'll be all right. And the tyres were a little bit sort of worn out and all that. And I thought, as long as I don't get some, you know, handy kind of national rider with a 1 litre bike on slicks, I'm going to be all right here. Anyway, first rider I had up for some instruction was a lad who was doing the MRO championship on a 1 litre Suzuki, and he's got good tyres and warmers, and they're brand new and all that, and I thought, here we go. So I told him, look, go out and do your thing, I'll follow you, at some point I'll pass you, and I want you to follow me, and we came up with a plan. Well, after a lap and a half, I could just about cling with him. I mean, he's pulling that much on each straight that I'm really working hard and risking quite a lot to stay with him and get back onto him through the corners, you know. And I was just about to sort of raise my arm and let him go and speak to him afterwards and say, look, mate, I wasn't prepared to push it any further. and I couldn't keep up. But he crashed to the gooseneck. He slid off across the front as he flipped. And I just remember thinking, poor lad, but thank God for that.
You do know what he was doing. He was like, okay, I'm in front of James Whittam, and I'm not going to let him pass me on an 848 with shag tires.
That's probably what I was doing. But to be honest, another half a lap, and I wouldn't have been near enough to see him, actually. It was just starting to drop me, and I was just thinking, and what I don't want to do, it's really difficult when you're instructing, because you don't want to be hard with it. You know, the backmarkers that you're passing, the slower riders, you really can't afford with the instructor's vest on to be harsh with them. You know, you have to wait if you're in the corner. You can't just dive under them to stay with this bloated instructor. You know, with a 1 litre, it makes it a lot easier.
Sure. Well, this may be one of the reasons why I stopped instructing, because I had a tendency to dive under people. Let's talk just a little bit about I want to talk about Suzuki. Because there are some interesting changes, and sorry to change the subject so abruptly, but Jack Valentine, Paul Denning, and everybody is going to World Superbike with the new team. What are your thoughts there? I personally think they'll be successful, because I think I see Suzuki at least taking their MotoGP money, which is gone now, and focusing on World Superbike. I think that might be something that has some promise. I mean,
I think you're dead right. I think that it's a bit odd the way it's all happened, because Francis Batter at All-Star was, they were kind of holding out for the Suzuki money, and then it didn't come. And then lots happened at MotoGP where people were waiting for the ride and it didn't happen. Hopkins was one of them. He was for sure hoping to get back into MotoGP somehow, if not with Suzuki, with I think one of the Honda teams. Now, the way it's worked out, I think they're going to be, I don't know how much effort Suzuki's going to put in. I think they're going to be reasonably successful. They've got two really good riders in Hopkins and Kamiya. I think Kamiya's going to suit the Suzuki. He's a big lad, is Kamiya.
I think so too.
Suzuki's probably the biggest physical sort of bike for him to get on. I think he'll be all right. I think Hopkins will go well, and I think he's a good team. I think that probably Jack Valentine is a brilliant team manager, but he can't see him keeping his job. If Denning would have known that he didn't have a job at MotoGP, I'm sure he would have been maybe thinking he'd run it himself at World Superbike. But, I mean, as it is, it's a good team, they're going to be a good asset to the World Superbike paddock, I think, this year.
What do you think of Eugene Laverty and Max Biaggi on the same team? You've got to kind of chuckle at that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the question mark over Aprilia is always funding, and can they afford to have as many bikes out as they want to have out there? Financially and technically. You always got the impression that if there was anything that worked a little bit better than the rest of the stuff, that Max was going to get it. But the way that Laverty has jumped on essentially what was Hager's bike in the couple of tests they've had, he's been phenomenal. He's been really quick. And I think that Max just might get a shock from his teammate this year.
I think you might too. The weirdest thing, James, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but we still seem to be in silly season, which never extends this far, because there are still a lot of question marks as to who is going where. Not a lot, I mean, but especially in MotoGP, certainly. Moto 2, all of that, and a little bit in World Superbike and probably in BSB as well. We don't know where everybody's going to land. Do you have any predictions for next year for World Superbike?
World Superbike, I think Laverty's going to be strong. You can never discount Max. He had a bit of a rough year this year, injury, blah, blah, blah. You've got to think that Checker, on the same form as he finished last year, on the same bar with the same team, has to be somewhere near. There's less top-notch factory involvement this next year because we've lost Yamaha. The bikes aren't going to be out there. And technically, right, they were one of the that was a top team with two top bikes out there, with two top riders. Now, if you look at those not been out there, there's two less factory top-level bikes. It's really going to be no harder, if you like, for Checker on paper than what, you know, his bike hasn't got any older or less competitive in the off-season, because there's actually going to be less full factory bikes out there next year than there has been this year. So Checker, you can't discount. The BMWs, what do you think? Well, Melandri's already gone fairly quick.
Yeah.
I chat with Leon Haslam all the time, and he's fairly confident and buoyant that they're going to have what they need. It's been massive team changes within BMW. Haslam went to him and said, look, this is what I want, and he had a wish list, and they just said, look, you can have everything you want. They've given
you and I talked about this before, because it was a very rigid team structure. Is the structure opened up in the BMW side and kind of given the rider a little bit more control?
Absolutely. They also, not, there's two things. The team structure's changed a lot. Leon's got the team, the crew chief he wanted and the technicians he wanted. Melandri's taken De Solli, who has been with Melandri about 3 or 4 years or over the years. He was his team manager in MotoGP for 2 seasons. So Melandri's got who he wants underneath him, which is a good thing. And also that they've decided that they're going to, instead of trying to reinvent the wheel with their own electronics, they're going down the same road as every other team. They're using more stock type electronics on the bike, not their own in-house system.
Because that has been basically failing so far. I mean,
I chat with Leon all the time. He said it's a complete nightmare. They look at everybody else's system and the German technicians, and they laugh because they're so simple and crude.
Yeah.
And then say theirs is a lot better, but it's that technical and difficult to get set up that it never actually is any better. It's worse, you know. So
yeah. Two gentlemen that I definitely look forward to. I'm really looking forward to 2012 World Superbike. There's a lot of kind of unknowns, and it's one of those seasons that I'm kind of walking into, going, I have no idea who's going to do well, my apologies for putting you on the spot, because if you asked me to make a prediction, I couldn't say shit. I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm the same. I really wouldn't want to pick a winner and bet my house on it this next year. Yeah. One man we haven't mentioned is Jonathan Ray and his teammate Arama. And Jonathan, I spoke to Jonathan at the show, and he's been really, really impressed with Arama, his speed anyway. And the way, I honestly thought Arama's problem would be getting off Bridgestone's and jumping on Pirelli's. Very, very different feel, and they feel so different the way they work. And I thought he'd struggle on it. And until you can get used to the thing sliding around just about everywhere the whole race, you're not going to get on with Pirelli's. And Bridgestone's are completely the opposite way. The harder you work them, the more they stick and they don't move. But he hasn't. He's got on with them. He's got to grips with them, and he's going pretty quick. So he could be a dark horse as well.
Well, remember, so Hero's gone from 250s to Moto2s to GP and all sorts of different bikes. I do want to talk to you about the show, but very briefly, I want to actually ask you a question, because I think it's interesting that you mentioned Checa and the fact that they're coming back with the 1198 next year, while the 1199 Panigale is going to be running in Superstock. Granted, you're coming back with a known good factor, But don't you find that a little odd?
It's completely odd. And I don't know really why it is, and nobody seems to know why they're not going straight in with the Panigale, the 1199. Now, when you look at the thing, it's a beautiful bike. Now, I've always seen the stock bike. There's two reasons, I think, that they may not be going with this in superbike trim. Number one could be that not being a massive manufacturer or having the funds needed, maybe to develop that bike into what they think or is going to be a race-winning machine, I don't know. Maybe they just can't afford to make that into a race bike. You know, they know that the 1198 works well and they've got everything in there that they need. And they know how it works. They've got the data and all that. Now, whether they think they're coming out with it, sometimes a brand-new bike these days, it doesn't work. You know, he needs the setup time. We've seen the R1 take a bit of time to get going. The S1000 RR BMW, that takes a bit of time to get going. You know, so maybe they don't think that they're going to be able to chuck the resources into it to get it into a proper race winning bike. Or it's a stressed airbox design. Now, that's just the way that they're going away from it. It's MotoGP. So, you know, whether they're thinking that as a road bike, it makes absolutely perfect sense. And
let it bed in.
It looks such a simple and beautiful design when you see it. It's lovely. It all works. But whether they think that's not going to transfer, you know, whether they think it's going to be inherently wrong for what they're trying to do on the track, I don't know.
Did you get a chance to ride Checo's bike at Portimao?
No, and the reason I didn't is because I've ridden all the bikes before over several years, but what actually happens is you get on the bike, you're given typically about 3 or 4 laps, and you can't afford to crash it, and you really haven't got the time to push on or get anywhere near what it's capable of doing. So therefore, it's way too hard going the 10 seconds, or 15 seconds laps that you're going than they go, and it just feels awful, and you can't wait to get off it. Any of these riders, any of these journalists who were 10 seconds slower than I was, and I was off the base, get off it and say that you know, this is this and that's that, and they go into every nuance of the way the chassis works, it's a lot of bollocks, because they really just wobble around for 3 laps, bring it back in one piece, and think they've done the job, you know. So, I'd rather somebody else do, because I'm not actually finding anything out. If you gave it me for 2 weeks, I'd be able to push it to within probably 4 seconds of what it can do, and I'd be able to feel what it was doing and how the suspension was working, the geometry. But in 3 laps, you've no chance. So I'm going to decline.
I'm going to pin you back, because, and I know exactly what you're saying, because how much fun is it to take a bike out and wobble around for 3 laps? No fucking fun, because it doesn't fit. Nothing works. You want to come back in. You want to adjust this, adjust that, and make it right for me. And it's going to take a whole day or days. But you said earlier, way back in the beginning of when we started talking, that you were going to do some road racing. So talk to me about that.
No, what happened? It was a complete mess, really. There was going to be a 6-hour world endurance round at Donington Park.
Right?
So my friend Paul Schultzmiss came up to me and he said, would you partner me on one of my S1000Rs in this race? I want to have a go at endurance. And I said, yeah, I'll get a license and we'll have a do. I said, I know if one of the top teams who were going to win it asked me, I'd have said no, because I knew I'd let them down. You know, I know I wouldn't be quick enough, or I wouldn't want to push that hard to try and win it with them. But I knew Shuey ain't going to win it anyway. So I thought we could have a wobble round, and I could, you know. I actually went testing a couple of times, and I got to the point where I probably would have surprised a few people. I think I'd have gone all right. I mean, I wasn't going to win it, I know that. But I could have done all right, I think.
I'm surprised you're not running world endurance rounds now, because that seems like the kind of thing that would get your edge up, and you still have the full capabilities of riding that fast, and probably have never fancied having a real good ride in the dark.
No, the problem with the World Endurance Championship as a whole is the fact that it takes so much time up, and really, you know, I'm away most. I haven't had a weekend at home, hardly. We've covered, as you know, I've covered BSB for Eurosport, I've covered TT for ITV4, and then World Superbike with Eurosport. And I haven't had a weekend off, and I couldn't have done hardly any of the rounds anyway. But what happened in the event, they cancelled the Donington meeting anyway. So that was me, 53 quid for an ACU licence that I'm never going to use. So, as I say, I am definitely going to do a little bit of lower-end racing this next year, maybe on a bit of a classic, maybe old TZ or something. I'm going to do something.
It better be on, like, an old RD350LC or something like that. You need to break.
I've got my LC out at the beginning of this summer, and I've done 2,500 miles on my 350LC this summer and enjoyed every one of them. I've also got a 350G TZ, which I'm fancying.
Nice.
Maybe one as well.
Yeah. Oop. You have to go.
Okay.
No, did I lose you?
No, you're still there.
Oh, no, I'm still here. I don't have to go.
Okay, not me.
Okay. So, you've got a couple of bikes that you've got out in the barn, I take it.
Yeah, I've got a few bikes, but you can't keep them all taxed and tested and road legal all the time. So what I do is I choose a couple at the beginning of the summer. This year I chose a 1980 350LC, really nice. I restored that about 10 years ago. I've done about 2,500 on that. Also, I taxed and tested a 81 Suzuki X7.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
They're lots of fun, then. They're very light, very unsophisticated compared to the LC, but because they're light and a bit lively, I quite enjoyed running the Suzuki as well.
Yep, I used to have a Kawasaki S1, which was the three-cylinder 250.
Yeah.
What a little dynamite box of doom that thing was. it's not like an H1 or H2. It actually stopped and went, but you had to wind the shit out of it to get it to go anywhere. So what are you planning on road racing next year? I have to ask you, what bike are you going to put on the road?
Well, I've got loads of options, really, because Paul Shoesmith always does three or four short circuit meetings, and I can run whatever he's got. So it may be on an S1000 RR BMW in super stock, or I've got an option of a 125 Honda.
Nice. Do it.
Yeah, I'm just thinking whether my technique. Now, I rode it a couple of years ago and actually won out of three races. I won one and finished second in two. But it was so difficult technique once you get out of the habit, you know, not having the power, having to use the clutch, having to keep the thing, run wide lines so you carry every bit of speed out of the corners. It was hard work for me, but I really enjoyed it. So maybe that, or maybe a bit of on the TZ350G. So I'm going to do something. As I say, I'm going to do. Now, there's an absolutely frantic twin shock and veterans motocross movement happening in Britain, you know. Because I used to do quite a lot of motocross back in the day when I was first road racing as a way of keeping fit during the winter. And the tracks back then, you know, we're talking 20 years ago, were very, very much old school, what you in Britain used to call scramble tracks. They were basically a boggy field with some tape and post round. And then what's happened over the last 25 years is tracks have grown into these kind of supercross, outdoor supercross kind of tracks with doubles and trebles and fields of whoops and...
It's shit out of you, basically.
If you're not good in the air and if you can't time the jumps and land off a 50-foot tabletop, you're not going to win. And so I stopped doing it because I'm not good enough not to hurt myself off a big jump, you know. So what's happened with the Twin Shock and Veterans movement is using all the old, Farmers Field, Hillside, motocross tracks that's got hardly any jumps in. It's all about turning and berms and all that, you know, and bogs. And I did one last year at a place called Pontrillus in Herefordshire, near Wales. And really, it was a veterans race, plus 40s, over 40s. And really, really enjoyed it. Finished in the teens, out of about 30. Really enjoyed it. Had a great day. Came home aching like I'd been beaten up. But really enjoyed it. And so I've bought myself a 1985 YZ 250. That's come directly from California and never seen a drop of mud. So I'm just speckling that now and I'm going to race that a bit.
I may have had a hand in that. I was a service manager for a Yamaha dealership in Northern California. In between my software careers. Have you ever had the opportunity to get yourself out on a proper supermoto bike?
Oh, on a supermoto bike?
Yeah.
I did a little bit of supermoto when it first arrived in Britain, as of about sort of 15 years ago. Obviously, on the tarmac bit, I was kind of all right, and on the muddy bit, I was not that brilliant, but I really enjoyed it. I didn't do as much as some of the road races. I know some of them are quite into it. Now, it's kind of dropped off a little bit now. There's one or two of the up-and-coming British Championship riders in Super Sport and Super Stock. Christian Eden, he's one of them. There's one or two of the up-and-comers in road racing who have come through the Supermoto British and World Championship route. So it's obviously good for your riding, you know.
I've always thought, though, from a training perspective, for a road racer, it was probably much better than riding motocross, because you can basically kill yourself riding motocross. And supermoto is typically done on road racing or kart tracks. You know, you look at Chaz Davis' little circuit that he has, and congratulations to Chaz out there, sir, yeah, for Sportsman of the Year and for the Wales District. But he's got a little kart track there, and I've seen him and Michael Laverty tearing around that place, and Eugene as well. And every time I see that that video, I think it's on YouTube somewhere, I'm like, oh, shit, I want to be on that track. And it's so fun just ripping around a little car track.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Fogarty got into it quite heavily just after he finished his road race career. And then he got me all G'd up. We all got bikes. And then he went to a place in northern Wales, Anglesey. They've got a little road race track. And he was playing about around there and broke his big fib. This was only about a year after getting better from his shoulder when he retired from road racing. So that kind of put the
cap. Kind of chill it out.
Yeah.
So you guys had your big road show, and you guys sold pretty much all of those out, you and Foggy, didn't you?
Say that again.
You and Carl did your road show all through the summer and fall, and it seemed to be very popular, and you guys did well.
Yeah, we did really well with it. We did another 12 shows, and we did some spring, some fall, and out of the 12, we packed out, we filled probably half of them, but some of them were sort of 800 seats, which you're never going to fill, you know, but we never did less than sort of 300-400 people, and as I say, most of the venues we packed out, and it went down really well. You can only go off what people say, and people seem to enjoy it. I asked a lot of people. It got good feedback on Twitter and this sort of thing. So, you know, we were really pleased with it. Carl came out of his shell a little bit, and by the end of it, it was quite the sort of entertainer, really. But we got asked to go on a cruise ship around the Mediterranean and do a couple of shows on that, but I actually can't go because it clashes with a lot of stuff I've got going on. But Carl's gone, and he's going to have a go on his own. I don't know just how he's going to sort of do it. He's going to have to change it a lot if I'm not with him, because the show we did was very much a sort of double act. But that's not to say he can't make it entertaining. If he can have somebody with him who can keep him going with the old stories, I'm sure he'll be all right. He's going on that at the end of Jan, so we'll see how we go. If they might throw him overboard if he's not funny enough.
Yeah, perhaps he needs an American cohort to just give him shit all the way through. I can't even picture the two of you apart, but I pestered your manager, and I'll dub this out of the show, but to record your damn show. You guys should have recorded that, and I could have recorded it for you, and I actually would have liked to had the opportunity, and if you want to do it next year, James, I'm telling you, if the Skype connection is good enough, I will be the voice on the far side of the pond with you and Carl, because I can get, I know I can give Carl shit and like tip him on his edge. So something to think
about. Well, it's not difficult.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to figure out a way to wrap this up. And you've given me, good Lord, you've given me almost an hour of your time. Thank you so much.
No problem.
It is fun. It's just fun catching up, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, and it's good. I mean, once the season finishes, we've had such a good finish, especially the BSB season, you're kind of ready for a bit of a break, think about something else. But now, it's, once you get Christmas out of the way, which we just have, you're kind of looking forward to getting going again, seeing who's going to do what, lots of change, especially BSB. Nobody knows how that's going to pan out, lots of changes in World Superbike. So, yeah, it's good to get chatting with somebody about bikes again.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. I hope you and your family are all well, and I had a brilliant Christmas, and I hope that you guys did too. Be safe, ride well, and get yourself into gear, sir, and I will see you at the aisle. And, oh, no, I take it back. I will see you at where? Shelsey, what's the name? Crosley Airfield?
Yeah, you get in touch before, and if I've got an empty seat, you can come across with me. And let me tell you, it's the most convenient way. I'll even do you a little sandwich for halfway there.
You're the man. You are the man. Cheers, James. Thank you so much, and we will talk to you soonest, maybe around round one.
No problem. I'll be there.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate. Cheers, mate.
Bye.
All right, and as always, wonderful to have James on the show. Martin, I know that you were desperately trying to get him, and the weather over there has been, well, shit. And
it took, so it took someone from California.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't able to fly in, and so finally dusted him up on the phone, and hope you guys enjoyed that out there. It's certainly always fun to talk to Mr. Whittem. And I absolutely appreciate the offer that I forced on him to fly me over to the Isle of Man if I can figure out a way to get over to that side of the pond next year. So, very, very cool.
Nice. Nice.
Should we just do another
one?
Yeah.
Let's just keep going through these, man. They're fantastic. Really good content.
All right. So, the next one up is going to be, Mr. Ben Spies, 2009 World Superbike Champion, currently factory Yamaha racer for in MotoGP. And
before you start, before we go into this, like last week Jim was kept saying, you got to listen to this interview, you got to listen to this interview. and I was really busy at work. I had just gotten back into work, and I finally found some time on my commute, during my commute, to listen to it. It's a really freaking great interview.
It's awesome, a really good interview. Yeah, it's
I don't think if Ben has talked this way before, so this is a really good one.
It is cool, and well, he doesn't give people this much time, and so you guys are going to get nearly an hour of Ben's piece and his very deep thoughts. And God, I hope you enjoyed it as much as
too.
I did. Yeah, let's roll it. Jim Race here for Motopod. We've once again got on the line with us, and I think it's been since last April, Ben Spies of the Factory Yamaha team. How you doing, Ben?
Yeah, good, good.
Excellent, excellent. I do need to warn you that I hit up the Weira bulletin board again for some questions, so you always know what that's like. We always get some interesting ones.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
But just some background for me and just a couple of questions that I have and I think everybody wants to know about. And I think the number one thing that popped into my head when I was trying to put a list down was, what did Assen mean to you? What did the Assen win mean to you, sir?
Yeah, I mean, it was huge. A dream that, you know, it takes a long time for things like that to set into people, and obviously different people take it in different ways. Everybody kind of knows I'm a little, you know, I'm a quieter personality when the TDs and stuff like that are out. But, you know, I'd say every time I think about it, you know, it kind of hits me more and more, and you realize, you know, what you've done. And you know, I'd like to make the next step and obviously win more races and win a championship. But when it goes back to thinking of just that race, you know, I think about how many, you know, years and time I've put into racing and always kind of, you know, trying to raise the bar of my potential, you know, every year. And like I said, watching years of the Assen track with battles with Swanson and Rainey and how historic that track is, being the oldest, you know, the GP on the calendar, and it being Yamaha's 50th anniversary year, the first race that they ran the red and white. I mean, there's so many things that, that made that weekend, not just for a first GP win, but, you know, just a win in general, huge. And, it was great. And like I said, every time I do think about it, I think, you know, it hits me different in different ways in different places, but it still keeps building on what it, you know, was. And again, I'd like to do, you know, more and win more for the fans and win more for myself. But, you know, I've always, you know, not taken time, but, you know, had to step up to new levels, you know, even when I was 16 to 18, it's not like we were the fastest person ever to hit a motorcycle. I mean, every year I've kind of had to challenge myself and go up a level. You know, it hasn't come easy, even though I've been quite fortunate with, you know, a lot of championships and race wins and stuff like that. We had to put a lot of work into it too. And you know, hasn't been the easiest road all the time, but, you know, it's been fun. So when I do think about that GP win, you know, I think of all the times and all the kind of hardships and having to kind of fight back and learn to step up, kind of put us in that place.
Do you occasionally watch that back on TV?
You know, I've probably watched the race, the actual race, maybe three or four times, but I've seen a lot of, you know, small clips, YouTube clips and stuff like that. But, when I look back at the race, it just, you know, blows me away how, you know, it shows with, you know, this year, I didn't make a big scene about it, but I didn't make a lot of excuses either. Just for whatever reasons, we had a lot, you know, up and down year, not consistent at all, had a few crashes. Even when I didn't have some crashes, I wasn't the most comfortable riding for whatever reason, and that just happens sometimes. But that day, I mean, it was, you know, I had all the confidence in the world, and it shows that at least I know when I feel like that it's, you know, it's there, you know, the other guys can be beaten and we can win races, whether it happens as much as, you know, Casey does, obviously not yet, but as Casey does or Jorge and people like that, you know, that's just, you know, all we can do is what we can do. But that day, you know, it was, quite a bit different than all the other Sundays that weekend. I mean, it was easy. You know, we had complete control of the race and you know, that's, gives me confidence for the future, but also, you know, we need to do it more often. And if it never happens again, it never does. And if it happens, you know, 20 or 30 more times, well, you know, we'll see. But, you know, at least we know that it can be done. We just got to, you know, figure out how to do it more often.
Well, if you think about it, so I think you had two podiums in 2010. You had four this year. So eight podiums in 2012. And you just kind of go exponential from there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, that's kind of been, like I said, my career, if you look back, it's always, you know, we've kind of made progress every season. Last season, yeah, we had more podiums, we had a race win, but consistency and DNFs and stuff like that, I would say it was one of my, you know, worst seasons in the last, you know, definitely in the last 5 or 6 years, but it's also at that level, you know, it's MotoGP and it's, you know, it's like 16 to 18, you know, all-stars just yep. facing off against each other. So you always, you know, pick apart yourself and when it's bad, you know, you come in, you're like in eighth place or ninth place when it's honestly not that bad, but you know, you've got to rise to the occasion, step up, and it's hard, you know, you know, we've got to try to make another step next year. It's going to be interesting with the bikes and then what happens in the future. But, yeah, in saying that, you know, last year wasn't that bad, but in my eyes, there was a lot of really bad moments, but, we also accomplished, you know, a dream for me and also beat four guys that hadn't been beat for like 6 years. So
yeah.
It definitely was a challenge, but, you know, we just got to, you know, keep working and see how next year goes.
Well, so I'm going to skip ahead here. Let's talk about injuries a bit, because with your crash at PI, you missed Sepang. Mm-hmm. You come back to Valencia and you nearly win the thing. I mean, how do you know when you're ready personally?
I mean, it's tough. You know, we had the whole season was difficult again, and it started at Silverstone when I had a really big crash in the wet and hit the wall pretty hard, and I had some kind of lingering injuries with my back, shoulder, and arm. It was all kind of from the it was definitely from the Silverstone crash, but it was one of those kind of injury that just takes time, because you have like so much compression in your back, everything's tight, then you pinch a nerve, and that's kind of what happened with my arm and shoulder and stuff for a good month and a half. We were just struggling with it, and with even Assen, I really wasn't physically 100%, but on the bike it didn't hinder me too much. But Phillip Island, we had a big crash and came back at tried to ride after I crashed at Phillip Island. I still qualified, but the next day I definitely didn't know where I was at. So didn't race there in Sepang. I tried to bounce back the next week. Wasn't the smartest thing in the world. I crashed twice and they pulled me off the bike, and even though I wanted to keep riding, didn't race there, and then went to Valencia, and the second session in the rain I was back on the ground again. So it was really hard to build confidence in the latter part of the season, but in the last race we had some confidence. It ended well and we were able to start the season with testing and stuff like that really good. But the year was just a lot of little lingering injuries that were just never fun. I mean, I remember I had a root canal right before, 2 days before a weekend started, and, just not the most comfortable, being in a helmet, the whole weekend, and things like that, some people didn't know about. But it wasn't the smoothest year, that's for sure. But, we were able to do some great things too. But, next year I just want to be more consistent, make that small step again, and just have things go, a lot more smooth, where we can enjoy it a little bit more. Half the season this year was just plagued with those, niggling little injuries that just add up to, not having fun a lot. So it was tough, but, that's part of it. It doesn't, as we've seen with, Valentino, it's not always a fairy tale, and he's had great luck through the years, not just great luck, but, good luck plus a whole lot of skill and everything going the right way. And then, it doesn't always go the right way. With Casey, we saw him get sick a few years ago. We saw, again, Valentino not have a great year, and it's not always, the prettiest thing or the easiest thing. So we just got to, try to build and get some momentum and just, have a little bit better of a year next year.
I'm going to be talking to Doc Costa of the Clinico Mobile in a couple of days, and I want to ask him about this, but I'm wondering, have you ever done the hyperbaric chamber thing?
Hyperbaric? No, I've never done that.
Okay. I'm curious about it. And I know some people have done it with some very serious injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've heard by now that Nick crashed a couple of days ago training on flat track.
I read that yesterday, actually.
And does hearing that sort of thing sort of make you ponder, less risky off-season testing? I mean, you mostly just cycle off-season, right?
Yeah, and, I definitely, before I get back on the bike, I try to get on, some two-wheeled stuff with the motor and kind of, refresh the skills. But it's, it's hard because you can't really motocross. I used to motocross quite a bit, had a couple injuries with that, and was kind of getting a little too comfortable with it and starting to go a little too fast. And then when the crashes happened, they were a little bit bigger. So I kind of had to slow down from that. And it's hard to find that balance of having fun, staying safe, doing the right training, stuff like that. Even with my cycling, I mean, that's, you do some races and, it's a bit sketchy here and there, but then, it's fun and it's it's great to do. So it's just hard to find that right balance. It's not like Nicky, I'm sure, was doing anything, out of the ordinary or anything over his head. Just, sometimes things like that happen and it's unfortunate, 'cause right about now is when you're really starting to, kind of start training again and getting, you know, it's a month away from the first test. So I'm sure it wasn't good news, and that sucks really bad that it happened like right at this time. It wouldn't have been so bad if it was a month ago, but
right.
You know, it's not, it doesn't, you know, give the greatest, you know, thoughts in your head and confidence, you know, doing it right now, but you know, at least it happened early enough. But, yeah, it's hard to find, like I said, that, you know, right training where you can have fun and you're always safe. You know, it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, and I think Cameron Beaubier, he was doing some dirt track the other day, up-and-coming American kid you probably know of.
Yeah, I've actually been following him quite a bit. I like him a lot.
Yeah, he's a good kid, local kid to me here.
Yeah.
I do have to ask you, and everybody has asked me to ask you, and it's a question that's peaking my mind, and I want to drag you back to the final corner in Valencia.
Yeah.
Because I want you to fill us in. You kind of ended up on the wet curb from the overhead view. To me, it looked like it killed your drive. People on the net want to say that Hanna and Casey simply out accelerated you. Combination of the two factors, what was the scoop?
You know, there was a few factors involved with it, and I can say that, as in, you know, missing a shift or spinning up on the curb, honestly, nothing, you know, nothing happened that didn't happen the lap before or anything like that. And I've watched a race a couple times, and, you know, if you watch when I was behind Dovey and Danny, you know, when I was behind them, I was just losing quite a bit of real estate
right
every lap on the exit of the corner. Plus, you know, it was raining quite a bit, at that point of the race. And, you know, when I had caught Casey, he just basically, you know, got him behind me and did everything I did. You know, and if obviously I had a big moment, he would have known that, you know, it's too slick. But when he was out there by himself, he didn't really understand the conditions so well.
Right.
I think, you know, in those type of conditions, having somebody right in front of you it's a lot easier, to lead. And at that point of the race, in all honesty, you know, what I was thinking was, I'd had a horrible four or five weeks in a row. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I just had crashed a lot. Didn't have much confidence at all. And then, you know, the race was definitely in some really sketchy conditions. And, you know, at the part of the race, I was in fourth place, just kind of plotting, okay, how can I get second? And then with, you know, six laps to go, all of a sudden I was in second, and boom, there was Casey. I mean, he was 10 seconds ahead of me. I never even thought
I know
winning the race. And all of a sudden it was like, whoa, he's there. Passed him, and I just kind of tried to stay on my own rhythm. But, you know, in the last lap, I could hear him, but with those Hondas, they're really loud. And, you know, they can be half a second behind you, and you can still hear them. So, you know, I didn't, going through the last sector, I knew he wasn't right on me, and I didn't want to throw the thing away and do something really stupid. I wanted to have a good result, but I also wanted to win the race. So I was trying to, you know, it was right on that balance of trying to be perfect and not screw up, but also win the race. And, you know, he said it in the interview, and I talked to him after the race. The last, you know, eight corners, he basically just turned his brain off and went for it. And, you know, he just got an amazing drive, and I didn't get a bad drive, but I might have, you know, I could have rolled probably through the corner a little bit quicker. I could have maybe taken a little bit more of a risk, but, you know, at that point I thought I had enough of a gap not to do anything silly and not throw it away, but, you know, it was, wasn't quite enough. And, you know, quite honestly, the Hondas had quite a big advantage, on acceleration, even in the dry condition, wet condition, whatever. You know, again, if you watch the beginning of the race, I was struggling. I was struggling against, you know, even Dovey, you know, coming out of the last corner. And you know, Casey's definitely a lightweight, and he did everything perfect too. So, you know, he no doubt, you know, did a lot better of the last sector than I did. But also, you know, they did have a bit of an advantage, on acceleration, but, you know, that's the way it goes. And, you know, I wasn't, let's just say I didn't lose sleep Sunday night after the last month I'd had leading up to that. I was second place. I wasn't upset with, you know, so that's positive too, because I didn't, you know, I had some confidence, but also I figure in my head that I'll have a shot to win again. So, you know, hope it gives you a little bit more of a drive. But, you know, he rode a great, last half lap. I mean, there, if you look at the gap that we pulled on Danny and Dobie the last few laps, and it's not, we weren't going slow. He just, it kind of shows too his season. You know, he was perfect, didn't make mistakes, and you know, he also said that he led the whole race. He wasn't going to lose it like that either. It was, you know, he rode really good and just put it together.
He's not a guy that ever admits to turning his brain off. I know that he came up to you in Parc Fermé afterwards. Did he, like, apologize for
That's exactly what he said was, I'm sorry. And I was like, dude, honestly, I was happy. I mean, I would have loved to have won the race. Almost more for my team and my crew than for myself on that day. But, you know, again, we to lose to him and to track him down that big of a gap we had, you know, we did a really good race. We just, you know, didn't get it in the end. And again, it's it could have gone a lot worse, and we could have had a lot worse of a season than we did. But, you know, we try to find the positives and you know, move on. But it wasn't a tough pill to swallow. Let's just say that after the 4 to 5 weeks I had before that.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So are you ready for some questions from the Weir BBS? And I do have a bunch. And so what I need you to do is tell me when you're starting to run out of time.
Oh, okay. That's fine.
All right. Some guy named Henry asks, how many oatmeal cookies you ate over the Christmas holidays?
Fuck my dad. I'm telling you, he makes him and my stepmom make the best oatmeal cookies, and luckily they got, you know, I look at them that they got a lot of fiber in them, so they're good for you. But yeah, I had quite a bit. Let's just say I didn't sleep well that night because I was a little full from everything they had cooked. So yeah, that's my dad.
According to Pops, he says his answer should be every single one of them.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually, I didn't, well, I guess I didn't eat them all in one night, but I did eat them all.
I thought I'd lead off with that one because that one made me laugh the most.
Yeah.
I guess he said you got him some luggage for Christmas. Does that mean you're going to be dragging him to more races?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's, you know, he made it to, I think, three races and a couple tests last year, and I think he's going to do the kind of same program and get him to some different races and try to get him to travel a little bit more. So he digs it, but he can see how it's pretty tough when you start going to Malaysia and back and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So he doesn't envy it all, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, I know for a fact that you weren't a big fan of flying back in the day when you were running AMA.
Mm-hmm.
And having done enough of my traveling at this point to understand the horror that jet lag, not to mention just flying on planes, can be, and as you well know, because you've gotten sick from planes, you've gotten sick from probably plane food.
Oh, yeah, when you're traveling in a germ capsule like that,
yep,
all the time, and your immune system is a little bit lower because you're jet lagged, you're tired, you know, you're around all those people, and it's not so much, you know, the flying that I don't like anymore. It's, you know, the airports, the,
uh-huh.
I wonder how many days you actually, you know, kind of lose during the year because you're just traveling, but, you know, it's better than sitting behind a desk, that's for sure, and but it's not always, you know, oh, I'm going to Spain and, you know, oh, you get to see all this, travel the country and all that. And,
nope.
You know, yeah, we do that. But also, you know, we don't have a lot of time actually where we go sightseeing either. So it's not always, you know, perfect, but, you know, it's definitely not bad. So, but I'm enjoying while I'm home, that's for sure.
Good. I bet. So some guy named Dave K, I think he's the only admin on the Weir BBS that's probably smaller than Danny Pedrosa. He wants to know
wow.
If you've heard so much of a peep out of Matt since you got to MotoGP.
You know, actually, I got a couple texts during my World Superbike, and I think in the beginning of MotoGP, just, you know, me and Matt have,
I know,
a funny relationship, and you know, Matt's not always a bad guy, that's for sure, and we didn't always not get along, and we've exchanged text a few times. He's not my favorite person in the world. I think everybody, you know, can understand, and anybody that's ever raced against Matt is an extreme competitor.
Yep.
Wouldn't take the years that we raced again back, and I think he would say the same thing, but I'm also glad that I didn't have, you know, 12 years of doing that either, but you know, it was great when it was. And, you know, again, I've got some congratulations and stuff like that from him. And I think it, you know, it stems from, he knows, you know, we've raced against each other. He knows how much work I've kind of had to put into it. And he's been to GP. He also knows the way the bikes are ridden. My size, my background, everything. You know, we raced against each other for a long time, and he knows how hard it is. And you know, he's we've got a great deal of respect for each other. And I'm sure that, you know, even though we haven't got along great in the past, I'm sure out of all the guys on the MotoGP grid, when I'm battling for the lead, he's probably hoping I'm coming out on top. You know, it's one of those kind of love-hate relationships that you see in box and race and all that kind of stuff. You know, we have a great deal of respect for each other, and that's also why we raced each other as hard as we did, why we, you know, Mouse got shot off and stuff like that. And there's always, you know, you can not get along with somebody on the track, but have a huge, you know, huge respect for him. And, you know, I respect Matt as a rider. Maybe not always what comes out of his mouth, but as a rider, as much as I do, you know, a lot of people in the racing world, for sure.
Well, I don't think you would be the rider today if you hadn't raced against Matt during his peak.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, it's that's been said a lot, and I think I would have become the rider that I am now, but it might not have. You know, I think I got there a lot faster, and it, right. You know, matured me a lot quicker. And you know, I think a lot of people agree to that, and I definitely do. But it made me, you know, step up in a lot of different ways, just from riding to mental stuff to dealing with, you know, dealing with somebody like that at you know, such a young age. So it just, you know, I grew up pretty quick racing against him.
Yeah, well, you would have had to.
And being with him.
Yeah. From SVB Rider, he wants to know, after your new burger joint venture, that's Stackhouse Burgers in Dallas, and I hope that's going well.
Yep.
He wants to know if you'll open a pizza place called Ben's Pies.
You know, I think Colin asked me that one time, and that was kind of a running joke. And actually, yep. I've been really, you know, into thinking about a pizza place like that, just from now kind of getting in the restaurant. I've always liked pizzas, coming, you know, being in Italy all the time.
I thought you were a big sushi dude.
Yeah, I mean, I have actually a small ownership in a big sushi bar in Dallas, and it's okay. Not like it is the burger place where I'm, you know, one of the majority owners. But, you know, I'm definitely into, you know, just putting a hand kind of, you know, in as many places as I can, and you know, try to see what happens. So it's, you know, you got to try to be as smart as you can with that, but also take small risk, and hopefully they work out. But it's definitely something that, you know, could work. And it's funny that, you know, that was actually the thing we were talking about doing first, but then we decided to do the burger joint. That's a little bit, not easier, but kind of learn the restaurant world a little bit more before, you know, you jump in, you know, with some you know, weights tied to your feet into the ocean. So you gotta, you know, try to learn as much as you can before you do anything like that. That's a little bit, you know, more expensive. So you never know what can happen in the future, and it's definitely been talked about. But the name of it, I might have to work on that a little bit. I don't know if many people would, you know, the ordinary people would know what that is or know who I am. So the racing card doesn't work as well in America as it does over in Europe.
No, I kind of chuckled because and I looked at your menu, and it's very simplistic, and I think that's wise. But I kind of chuckled because I caught you on a cooking show. Your local cooking show in Dallas the other day.
Yeah.
And you did not look very comfortable.
Well, you know what it was it kind of turned into a little bit, you know, something else. And I didn't know, you know, it wasn't going to be a cooking segment at first, and it was going to be an interview. And then they, you know, wanted to talk a little bit about the restaurant, but also maybe a little bit of a holiday dish too. And I was like, you know, I love food and I do love cooking, but I'm not a chef. You know, so It was we were trying to find the mix of everything, but yeah, it was also a long weekend before that, so I wasn't very well rested, but it was fun, you know, to do something different, try to you know, go down some different avenues, see some different people, and get some more media just from, you know, not just racing, you know, promote the restaurant, but also try to give people like an insight of, you know, that, hey, they've got, you know, a fellow, you know, Dallas Tech, you know, Dallas, that's, you know, doing something a little bit different and try to get people to, you know, learn a little bit about stuff.
I agree, especially now that off again, that it sounds like Austin's going to happen. It would certainly do to have a little bit more promotion for MotoGP in Texas.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm always into, you know, doing what I can for the sport and trying to, you know, trying to build it. It's just tough. And, you know, the U.S., it's not, like, as we know, it's not the biggest thing. But, you know, I wish we could get some more media, because anybody – that I've ever seen go to a race that even doesn't, they might not be a fan of me or a family member of me, but they come with somebody that knows me, even, you know, all of a sudden they see a race and they're like, you know, holy crap, this is cool. And they're hooked, you know, you know, it's definitely missing that the media exposure to grow in the sport. You know, I think it's very exciting, and just, you know, trying to find ways, you know, to work it into the normal people's schedule and where they can see it and understand it and you know, things like that. And hopefully the Austin track, everything goes with that, and everything keeps, you know, looking like it's a positive note, which what I understand it is. And hopefully we can do some more, you know, advertising and just get, you know, start with Texas, try to build it up. And, you know, we've been saying that for a long time, but, you know, you never know. It's not, definitely not too late. And we just got to, you know, do what we can for the sport.
I agree. All right, a couple more questions here. This one I thought was really interesting, and I've thought about it myself. This is from Nick Lafergy. Ben, would you like to see a few double headers on the MotoGP schedule similar to World Superbike format? Do you think there are any advantages or disadvantages to a single race per weekend versus the double-headed format? And do you think a few select double-header rounds would add to the drama and create a more exciting weekend?
Yeah, it definitely can. You know, it's with the MotoGP bikes now, there's so much setup. There's so much setup oriented that you can make a big change, and it just makes such a huge difference, because you get the top five, top six guys that are very, pretty much on the talent level, I think, are pretty even. And then, you know, you get your bike that's working perfect or whatever, and it just, you know, it makes that big difference. And I think from a standpoint of that, it can make it more interesting from, you know, just the weather to, you know, things you learn during the race. There's just so many things that doubleheaders, you know, can make racing better. It can make it worse for somebody, and it just kind of depends. And I mean, personally, I would love to see a few less rounds, but maybe double headers on some of them, if not all of them. I definitely would like it. Doing double headers with 17 or 18 weekends wouldn't be my ideal situation. You know, having like 14 weekends or 15 weekends like World Superbike, throwing double headers in, you know, 10 of them or all of them, you know, I think that would be, I think it could be a positive thing, but, you know, then it's again, you have the engine rule with the everything, and it gets confusing. But, you know, I wouldn't mind it at all.
Cool. Carmelo and everybody else out there in FIM and Erland, take note, please.
Yeah, exactly.
Steel Toe wants to know, why aren't we seeing more Americans going to GP? Do you think we have anyone here who can make the jump? And in that same vein, Colin has mentioned more than once that your passport determines your treatment. Have you ever experienced that in a negative way yourself?
What did you say?
That your passport can determine your treatment.
You know, yeah, I mean, it definitely can. It's the European culture is very, they're very positive about racing, but they definitely, you know, for whatever reason, will have their, you know, favorites or who they want to represent and who they like racing. And you know, it's funny with the Italian and the Spanish, you know, they like a lot of personality, and they thrive on that. And that's kind of, they're such emotional people. And just from living over in Italy, as much as I have, I've got to understand that. But and I've got a lot of fans and have a lot of support, that has kind of blown me away, over there, because I'm not the loudest personality, you know, at the paddock, and it's just, you know, that you are who you are. And for whatever reason, some people, you know, they like certain riders for whatever reasons more than others. And I think it can have, you know, something to do with that on, some bigger decisions. Maybe not so much with fans, but with, rides and things like that. Just like there's always, you know, they want to have a Brit in the series. They want to have, right, you know, a Japanese person. They always want to have somebody from a country there. And you know, from somebody coming from America, it's really tough right now too, because of the way the series is in America. It's such a big difference, to go to GP. We've got nothing like it. Right. Not even, you know, real super bikes now. So it's tough with how much data and how much bikes you have to change geometry wise and know about the setup when racing in America, being basically super stock bikes and super sport bikes, jumping on a real super bike for a younger kid is definitely huge. And then a GP bike is a whole nother level. It makes it hard, and it's hard to understand, you know, talent wise, who can make the jump and who can't.
Right.
And I haven't been able to watch enough racing to really quite understand it. Like we said earlier, that Cameron kid, I think he has a load of talent. Seems like a really nice kid. And there's definitely some other, you know, younger guys and obviously just talents in America, but it's just hard to really understand what, who can make that jump or not. And it's kind of a risky thing to take, for GP teams not knowing that. So it's hard because, you know, you want to see more Americans and more people over that. But even coming from here, I can understand how they would be a little bit gun shy to be ready to try somebody. So it's, you know, it's difficult right now for anybody, and especially to make the jump, to get to GP, but also from a team's perspective, it's hard to understand who's really ready and who can do it.
Yeah. I mean, you see kids like, you know, Josh Day going over, you see PJ Jacobson's going over to World Super Sport next year with a good team, PTR. But you're right. I mean, how do you really know, and who's going to take that leap? And especially with the economy the way it is right now in not only the motorcycle sales industry, but the motorcycle road racing industry itself, it's hard. I mean,
it's really hard too. And going back even to look at it a different way is, you know, like when I was coming up and Nicky was a little bit ahead of me and Roger was about the same and Hopkins was a little bit ahead of me. People like that. You know, we were on Formula Extreme bikes that had 200 horsepower when I was 17 years old, 18 years old. And the same thing with Nikki, even going back to Curtis and people like that. And now it's almost seemed like some of the younger kids they've stayed, and maybe not, you know, necessarily by choice, but they've stayed on smaller bikes so long. You know, it's by the time they get to thousands and big horsepower bikes, they're already, you know, into their 20s. And it's, you know, definitely the learning curve. It makes it a bit more steep in some areas with, you know, and definitely has something to do with the economy too. So it's just tough, you know, on a lot of different fronts. But it's hard to get to World Superbike GP and all, obviously with that when you're riding a 600 and you stick around there too long or you know, things like that. So it's, but also in saying that, if you're, you know, if you've got the talent when you're 15, 16, 17, someone's going to, you know, put you on one of those if you're just blindingly a lot faster than everybody else. So I don't know if it's something to do with the, you know, we see some countries dominate for a long time and things like that. And I just don't know, you know, it's hard to understand kind of what's what you know, we saw Spain, they dominated kind of everything. So it's, you know, I don't really know, because I don't want to knock anybody and I don't want to, right. You know, say that somebody's ready when they're not, or you know, just say names to say names. It's really tough because just the way the racing's so different and the way it's changed in America the last few years.
Well, okay, so and that brings up an interesting point, because with the slow demise of two strokes going out, you know, 125s are kind of gone from favor. Now four strokes are the preferred, or not necessarily the preferred step up. You went from like a 125 to a TZ 250 to a 600, and then from there on, most people probably don't know that you have two stroke experience in your background.
Yeah, I mean, I had, you know, a bit in saying that I was off a 250 by the time I was 15. So I went a very long time without riding two strokes. And obviously they're at a little bit different of a level of like a 250 GP bike.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, it was, but I was also, when I was 14 years old, a lot of people didn't know I was actually doing track days and stuff like that on a 750,
yeah,
street bike. So, I had a lot of two stroke experience, but then again, I went so long and my riding style evolved so much to being super bike base only. And then you go to MotoGP when an 800's basically just a 250 with a lot of power. And then we go to thousands next year, and a lot of people think, oh, it's a thousand, it's going to be like a super bike, when it really isn't changing that much. It just has a lot more power, a lot more torque. So it's, you know, the bikes are just totally different. And, they're definitely the Europeans, they have a lot more of a advantage coming from 250s.
Right.
Not only because they're more similar to the bikes, but also the riding style, the tracks, everything. They're just so different from what, you know, everybody's used to riding to in America. And, you know, we've seen, you know, greats like even Bayless. You know, he won a GP race and he did well, but, you know, I don't think he did what his talent, he didn't reach his full potential when he was in GP, just because he didn't have enough time. And also, you spend so long on super bikes, when you make that switch there, you know, you have to be willing to try to change and do that a lot. When if we put all the GP guys on the super bike, I think the results might not change, but the racing would be a whole lot more, you know, a lot closer and, you know, quite a bit different. So it's just, you know, it's hard, and not saying two strokes are the way to go, but the guys that spend a lot of time on the 250s, I think, have a bit of an advantage. And the Moto 2 bikes now are a bit different from the Moto GP bikes. So I think a lot of the Moto 2 guys, besides the ones that have an extreme amount of talent, you know, struggle a little bit when they get on the GP bikes.
It is going to be interesting to watch how the transition works from Moto 2, because, I mean, while we know Tony Elias had a wonderful championship, Tony's kind of a different character, as you well know.
Yeah.
And was not re-successful when he came back to MotoGP and is going back next year. Great for him. CRT bikes next year, in combination with your guys' factory 1000s, you know, to me, it doesn't seem like it's obviously going to be competitive between the two different factions, even though they get a whole bunch more fuel and more engines. But I have a feeling as the year goes on, and maybe over the next year after that, things may tighten up a little bit.
Yeah, and I hope they do. I mean, next year, I don't want to dog the CRT bikes, but, you know, they're unproven.
Yep.
Next year, it'll probably just kind of be kind of two separate championships almost.
Right.
But, you know, it's definitely the future is trying to make everything closer. And if they have that stuck in their head, then they're going to do whatever it takes to make the racing more closer. If that's bringing down the limits of the bikes, the tire performance, whatever, they're going to find ways to make the bikes at least not necessarily slower, but as in speed wise. But if you drop the performance down, you know, from a bike that, let's just say a factory GP bike on all standards or 100%, if you drop them down to 80%, a lot of the guys in the paddock can ride that bike to its max potential.
Sure.
And you're going to see closer racing where at the end of the race, it's more just the pure talent or the rider that's taken the most risk. When right now, you know, it's such a feel thing because the bikes have so much of a level that, you know, maybe you don't always get to it. But, you know, if you drop the tire level down, you know, knock them down with a lot of grip, then a lot of the guys can ride it to that level. And I think that's also why we see such good racing in super bikes and things like that, because, you know, the level of the bikes are just a lot lower. So more of the guys can ride them to their potential and you see better racing.
You know, I think there's still a misconception that a lot of people think that on a GP bike, you can basically get to the apex, you know, like, and just whack the throttle open without worrying about high setting. I think it's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, you still got a brake light. You've got a corner speed is the most important thing in GPs. And yeah, I mean, pretty much any guy in GP can get to the middle of the corner, you know, open the thing up wide open and let the traction control start, not open it immediately. I mean, that it, people have that misconception in their head that they can just pin the thing and everything's going to be fine. But yep, you can get the thing where it's at its potential, where it's spinning, but on the traction control. But the key is, you know, going fast enough where it's off the electronics, but on that borderline and you know, making momentum and making the speed. And not slowing down too much in the corner, because, you know, I can slow down 5 mph slower than the other guy and hold the thing wide open, and then you're just kind of spinning. But your whole roll speed was, you know, 5 mph from the apex out slower, and by the time you get to the end of the straightaway, it's a huge advantage. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's not just, you know, going in there, whacking the throttle open, and you're going to be as fast as everyone else. It's trail braking, braking deep, having that whole momentum of the corner speed that leads to the next corner. So it's definitely not just that easy, you know.
Yep, no doubt. You know, there was something interesting today, and timing was kind of odd, and there was a joint press release from YRC, your folks, and Petronas, sort of celebrating the partnership with those guys for the last few years, but it sounds like they're not going to be back. But I know you have a contract. Does the sponsorship thing still worry you about for the team anymore, or have you just sort of all let that go?
I mean, no, it's, you know, I know Yamaha's definitely going to be racing in GP for
ever.
Yeah, well, I mean, you never know forever, but, you know, they're definitely going to be not anytime soon is Yamaha not going to be racing. And I definitely know that. But it's also, you know, you've got to earn that spot. So for me, I'm not worried so much on, you know, is there going to be a ride option. It's just, am I going to go fast enough to deserve it more than someone else? And that's that. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, that's all I can actually do is just ride the bike as fast as I can, try to win races, try to have a good ride, try to have a good team around me. And if you don't perform, you're not going to have a ride. But I don't think it's going to get that bad where, you know, I don't have a ride because, you know, the sponsorship. I think it's just going to be, you know, a speed thing at the end of the day, which is you know, I guess what everybody hopes for. But, you know, I do know that, like I said, Yamaha's going to be around for the next few years for sure. And I just got to do what it takes to be on the bike and you know, try to step up and do things, for me, for America, trying to always, you know, push a barrier and win a world championship. That's the goal. So it's, now the sponsorship stuff doesn't worry me. I mean, definitely it's a hard time in the economy and things like that. We all know that from anything, any industry you're in. But, you know, it's, again, at the end of the day, I just got to try to do my job. And if I do it, you know, I'm definitely going to be racing for a while.
Well, I don't think speed is an issue that you really have. Hey, what's the latest word on the, Elbows Racing Elite Cycling Team? Are you guys going to be kicking ass again in 2012?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. You know, we've got some great sponsors and you know, everybody's back again for next year. And you know, some sponsors have been increased and, you know, we've got a couple new riders and have the same team we had last year, which was great. We had a, you know, a young guy that's been, you know, definitely, you know, stepping up, all the time. And you know, we have a couple really good guys that are joining the team next year and just taking it year by year. You know, I don't have any crazy aspirations of the team, but I also don't have a limiter on it. You know, I'm just kind of letting it do what it's going to do. And these guys now, you know, we started the team with a lot of, you know, the sponsors from a different industry, but they're also really happy now with, how well they've done. And it's now it's not just a me thing, you know, that they're involved with. I mean, the team's actually doing their part and really doing a good job. You know, just having fun with it again, just trying to give, you know, people opportunities. And I think they're relishing it and having fun you know, just seeing where it takes off. It's one of those things where there's been a couple cycling teams that started, you know, from nothing. They're in the Tour de France now. And right. That's really tough. I mean, that's not even on the horizon at all, but it's,
I was going to ask.
No, we're just, you know, again, I wanted to have a really good Texas amateur team you know, they were second in the country for the first year, which was insane. Again, we just try to take small steps, and if it works out and it builds up and keeps going, that's great. But we don't have any pressure with it. We're having a lot of fun, and hopefully it can keep going, and we can keep filtering, you know, younger guys that go to Europe or go to bigger teams and things like that. But right now I don't have any, you know, big-headed goals of the team's got to do this, or we've got to get to pro status or go to Europe or nothing like that. So I've just learned kind of when you're having fun with something, and you don't put a whole lot of pressure on yourself, that's usually when it makes it or you know, things like that, when you're not just, you know, trying to make it happen. So I've got a guy that really runs the team you know, is trying to work it like a business and see what happens. But, you know, it's been going really good. And next year, I think it's going to be really, really great for the team. Yeah, I mean, for all the sponsors that have been in it, it's been great. And it's only been a year, and we'll just, you know, kind of see where it keeps going.
Fun. I mean, well, and it's obviously a killer training opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. You know, I train, you know, definitely a lot with it, but also I just like riding my bike. I mean, it comes down to, you know, yeah, I mean, you really, you know, if you ride an hour a day on a bicycle or an hour and a half and do the right kind of stuff, you're going to be fit, you know, to race MotoGP. I mean, a lot of the riding I do is just because, you know, I flat out like riding my bicycle. I mean, that's all there is to it, or just doing, you know, whatever. I mean, I do gym stuff, I, you know, play basketball, whatever. I mean, it's not that, you know, I'm just like, cycling's it, but it's just, you know, I have fun doing it. It's a fun way to, you know, kind of get with the community and hang out with different people. You know, it's cool.
You, kick Turtle off the team yet?
What's that?
Did you kick Turtle off the team yet?
You know, Turtle hasn't raced so much. I gotta have a sit down talk with Turtle. No, it's, yeah, he's more, you know, roots the team on right now. He hasn't made it quite to the racing part of it. He talks about it quite a bit, though.
Well, don't we all?
Exactly.
All right, listen, I should let you go. Thanks for spending the time. Any big plans for New Year's?
Actually, just probably going to go, you know, hang out maybe at the restaurant a bit and, you know, hang out with friends. And that's kind of what I've learned, too, is traveling as much as I do. You know, when I'm back home, I like being home, and I like hanging out with friends and family, and you know, that's about it. I mean, we're just gonna, you know, hang out and you know, have a beer or two and hopefully make it to midnight. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm still wondering about that myself. Yeah. All right, brother. You have yourself a wonderful New Year's then, and hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime before maybe the season starts up.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
All right. So thanks very much, Ben Spies and Jim, obviously, and good luck with the franchise.
Ben Spies.
Yeah, there you go.
Should we just roll out with Doc Costa and then we'll come back and kind of finish this thing up?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So for this interview, Jim was asking a lot of our listeners. So a lot of the questions that you'll hear actually came from the listeners,
you guys,
from myself, from Martin. So thank you for everybody who pitched in on this one. It, you know, obviously, you know, we had a very dark spot in the 2011 season. So that comes up, and a lot of other kind of stuff that is difficult to talk to a medical team leader, especially somebody with Costa's history. I mean, like, you guys are going to be blown away by how far back this interview goes in places. So
Joel, it was really weird coming at it from the perspective of both a racer and a corner worker.
Oh my God, that's right. Because you also done corner work too.
Yeah, for me to do it, and I was
and a fan, and you know, and somebody who was, you know, a kid when Dr. Costa was already, you know, facing
exactly
these situations, you know, every day.
Yeah, and to be honest, I have the most respect for the gentleman, and so this was an interview that I. This may have been one of the scariest interviews that I walked into. And I walked into it, and as you guys will hear,
It took you a while to get your feet down. Yeah.
But I think I got them down.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Well, anyway, let's enough of the intro. Let's get this one on.
Go. Roll.
Jim Race here for Motopod, and with a very special guest, somebody that I have talked to many times at the circuit.
Sono qui, okay, Jim Race qui oggi con Motopod, e qui oggi per parlare con una persona molto speciale con cui abbiamo parlato diverse volte al circuito.
And that gentleman would be one Dr. Claudio Costa of the Clinica Mobile, perhaps one of the most important components to motorcycle road racing that we have today.
Okay, e quella persona naturalmente Dr. Costa, una delle persone più speciali che lavora oggi nel mondo del moto mondiale, è una persona che ha contribuito tantissimo al nostro mondo delle corse.
Dr. Costa, and because we have to go through interpretation, this is going to be interesting. I've never done this before, but I guess I'm just going to ask questions. I ask questions of my listeners, and Steve, you don't have to interpret all of these, but one of the questions that popped up right in my head was, who is going to replace you, Dr. Costa, when you retire?
Ok, la prima domanda che mi viene spontaneamente di chiederle, quando si ritirerà dalla scena o andrà in pensione, chi sarà la persona che la può sostituire?
A tutti quelli che amano i noi del mondo mondiale.
Ok, well, my spontaneous answer to that is to say that the people who would carry on my work would be the people who I love and admire most in this world of racing, and that would be my friends and the heroes of motor racing themselves, hopefully the riders.
Ah, very, very interesting. We certainly understand that your team, and it is truly a team, has made some incredible not only advances in motorsports protection and safety and survivability, but bringing that spirit forth to the racetrack. One of my listeners asked, and I kind of wondered, has there ever been any medical clearances, like allowing a rider to go back out, that you've regretted giving?
Okay. Naturalmente sul team negli anni ha fatto molto progressi dal punto di vista medico, dal punto di vista dei soccorsi, la qualità dei soccorsi, e abbiamo visto un'elevazione del livello di sopravvivibilità degli incidenti. Però porgo una domanda, c'è mai stato un'istanza in cui ha avuto il rimpianto di aver rimandato qualcuno in pista e poi di averci ripensato dopo? The simple answer to your question is that the doubt is always there. Yes, it's never an easy decision. Even any rider who's sent back onto the track, whether that be with an injury or a simple fever or temperature, there's always a doubt there as to whether or not you're doing the right thing.
Ma qui ho capito che sono i dubbi che dischiudono la coscienza e non viceversa.
So from here, that's how I learned how to understand that it's really doubt that is the guiding light in some ways in making decisions and not certainty.
E la seconda cosa meravigliosa è che tutti i piloti feriti o malati sono sempre andato più forte di quelli che erano sani.
The other thing that comforts me is I've noticed that it's the wounded rider or the rider with an injury who, when he returns to the track, it's him who tends to sort of travel to ride much faster than the ones who are actually fit.
Oh, sure.
But I have to say, until they come over the finish line, then there's always something of a sense of anxiety before the race is over, yes.
E per dirgli la verità, un rimpianto ce l'ho. Il rimpianto è con Jarno Saarinen, che gli ho tolto il gesso. Un gesso che avrebbe tenuto due mesi, che se avesse tenuto quel gesso l'avrebbe avuto anche il giorno di Monza. E invece io gliel'ho tolsi un mese prima, dove lui vinse molte gare, fra cui la 200 miglia di Daytona e di Imola, gare del campionato del mondo, ma dopo andò a morire a Monza. E questo quella notte mi ha, diciamo così, riempito di angoscia. Mm. E sicuramente è stato il momento più difficile per la mia vita.
Looking back on one particularly famous case, I would say that if I did have any regrets, it would be the haste with which we tried to treat Saarinen. As you probably know, he died in Monza. He was supposed to keep the plaster on his injury for 2 months. If we'd had extended the period of keeping the plaster on, then obviously that particular day in Monza, he still would have been under treatment and would have been unable to ride. So I think definitely the night in which he died was a particularly difficult one for me personally, and one in which our medical decisions, of course, were shown to be, you know, very human decisions that that inevitably lead sometimes to you know, a great deal of anguish.
Well, certainly, as and myself as a former rider and as a doctor under unusual circumstances, and it has to be for the Clinica Mobile, you make human decisions, and sometimes they're not perfect, but that is what you have to live with as a person. Has there been anything that's changed with obviously the Clinica has grown in technology and advanced over the years? Is there anything that's changed or that's new that is allowing the good doctor to advance care at the track?
Okay, naturalmente le decisioni che fate sono anche decisioni umane, quindi chiaramente non si può fare sempre la decisione perfetta perché non esiste. Comunque, a livello tecnico vorrei chiedere, negli anni o recente, negli ultimi anni, ci sono stati degli avanzamenti che hanno permesso di migliorare notevolmente proprio il livello di sicurezza su pista? Yes.
Questo è stato formidabile per il lavoro fatto dall'IRT e dalla Dorna, dai tecnici dell'IRT e della Dorna, fra cui Frank Puncini, che hanno migliorato enormemente i teatri in cui si svolgono le gare, per cui non essendoci gli ostacoli praticamente è facile curare chi non si fa male.
Okay.
Questo è stato un lavoro perfetto. I teatri non sono ancora sicuri al 100%, ma hanno fatto dei progressi che sono incredibili, quindi grazie al lavoro che è stato fatto bisogna rispettarlo.
The massive advance in safety on racetracks that we've seen over the last decades has really not been a medical advancement. It's really been a question of organization. We really do owe a lot to the organizers of IRTE and Dorna, who have made massive progress in track safety. Sorry, IRTE and Dorna. A few decades ago, you would have seen obstacles on the side of the track that would have been lethal in the event of a fall. Much work has been done to prevent injury in the first place. So now, obviously, we're seeing riders who are sliding with relative comfort, let's say, into gravel pits or onto the grass and not encountering fixed obstacles, which in the past used to wreak terrible damage and make, obviously, the doctor's task extremely difficult from the outset.
Okay, and I guess in the same vein, it's an interesting question just from my perspective. Helmets, leathers with airbags, what are the doctor's impressions on those?
Okay, quali sono le sue opinioni su le tute con l'airbag incorporato?
Sicuramente La cosa più bella è che i piloti del motomondiale che stanno sperimentando questo metodo di protezione stanno dando un aiuto a quelli che sono gli autodromi tutti i giorni, che sono le strade e le autostrade, quindi a coloro che sono il cuore del motociclismo, che sono quelli che vanno con la moto incontro a quella che è l'avventura e a cercare orizzonti nuovi. E quindi questa è una cosa molto bella e inoltre penso che abbia anche un valore per quello che riguarda la protezione dei piloti durante la corsa, ma la cosa più bella è che questo metodo di protezione verrà dato a tutto il mondo che corre con le moto incontro ai suoi sogni.
The obviously the development of the airbag system for the riders is something that's linked not just to the racing world, but it's linked to the motorcycle riding world as a whole. Sure. It's something that's obviously going to increase safety not only on racetracks but on roads as well. It's something in which the motorcycling industry and the motorcycling community as a whole has been participating in. My opinion is that, yes, it increases safety, and it's something that, more importantly, that will help riders and racers in particular to continue racing and to continue pursuing their dreams.
Very true. But a couple of our listeners asked, and I am curious too, is how difficult is it to administer the proper amount of pain medication given a rider's injury during, you know, qualifying, or how much do you figure out how to give a rider without dulling that edge prior to a race? And it's something that has always worried me, and it was the same thing when I raced. How much can I take?
Okay. Una domanda da lui come ex corridore anche è quanto difficile gestire l'utilizzo degli analgesici, cioè gli antidolorifici, troppo poco, e naturalmente il pilota non è in condizione di guidare, troppo è magari quella concentrazione che gli serve per vincere o per partecipare nella gara non c'è, quindi quanto è difficile gestire l'utilizzo degli analgesici e come si fa a calcolare la dose giusta?
Invece, la cosa che stupisce è che i piloti di moto hanno un rapporto diverso da quello che si possa pensare con il dolore.
Let me just start by saying that really motorcycle racers have a very different relationship with pain compared to the general population, and I'm sure that's something that you yourself will be aware of.
Perché il dolore diventa assume un significato importantissimo.
Because in racing, pain itself takes on something of a rather more different significance than in the everyday world.
Sure.
Perché è proprio la presenza del dolore che dà al pilota la sensazione di andare a sfidare un altrove.
So it's really the actual presence of the pain itself that gives the rider the sensation of challenging something which is perhaps greater than himself, which acts as a stimulus to even heightened performance.
Un mondo di cui lui sente la nostalgia che è nascosto dentro di lui.
It's almost as if by sort of facing that pain, by confronting the challenge, that he's rediscovering, a world in almost a nostalgic way, a sort of a perfect world in which one is able to face challenges under certain conditions without any of the normal obstacles or breaks that are placed on us when we're in everyday life.
E nell'oscurità, nella penombra di quel mondo, trova tutte quelle risorse e tutti quegli aiuti che lo portano a guidare la moto. Quindi non c'è una grande necessità dell'uso degli antidolorifici.
So the simple fact is that there isn't actually a great need for painkillers because it's often that pain which sharpens the concentration and which actually allows the rider to reach a sort of a higher plane of awareness that gives that race performance.
Le forze le trovano dentro di loro e noi se andiamo solo dare quel poco che addirittura inizialmente questo ci aveva sorpreso, praticamente quelli che sono i dosaggi degli antidolorifici e degli anestetici sono praticamente incredibilmente bassi rispetto a quello che uno potrebbe pensare, rispetto a quelle che sono l'entità, le gravità delle ferite con le quali i piloti riescono a correre, come la storia di McDougall.
The thing that's always surprised us right from the outset of the Clinica Mobile was the incredibly low dosage that was required. Given some of the injuries or some of the pain that some of these riders were facing, as doctors, we would have initially thought that much higher doses would be required. But as so many of the stories from competitive motorcycling show, especially the story of Mick Doohan,
right,
riders are capable of incredible things, even under extreme physical duress, pain included.
No doubt. And thank you for that. This will lead into a second question for me, because this is where, for you as clinicians, becomes incredibly difficult. How do you figure out when to release a rider when there is a concussion involved, and because riders are able to mask some of the symptoms? How can you actually follow that through and be able to say, okay, go race?
Okay. Una domanda di seguito, dopo quello sugli antidolorifici. Spesso ci sono le condizioni in cui magari un pilota ha una commozione cerebrale, però i piloti sono anche molto bravi a mascherare questo sintomo. Quanto è difficile e come decidete se è il caso di rilasciare un pilota per rientrare in pista o no?
Bene, oggi abbiamo la fortuna che la tecnica è talmente avanzata che con una risonanza e un attack possiamo dire che quel cervello è sano, non ha subito lesioni, per cui il pilota credo che in grande sicurezza può riprendere a correre dopo un traumatico, una commozione.
Ok, so, well, yeah, after a concussion, what helps us the most has been the incredible advances in technology over recent years. For example, now after a concussion or any suspicion of any brain injury of any kind, magnetic resonance or a CAT scan will give us a very clear picture of what's happening with the brain, and will give us a very good degree of certainty as to whether or not any injury has been sustained, and whether or not it's the case to release the rider for racing. When it comes to concussion, thanks to the tools at our disposal, we can generally sort of put a racer back on the racetrack and feel fairly comfortable about doing so.
So, in my other job in the medical industry and being very familiar with MRI and CAT scans, I understand that you could see like swelling around the brain and things like that. But when you look in a rider's eyes, maybe after a simple tumble or somebody's brought him in off the ambulance, sometimes you have to trust that.
Naturalmente non è sempre possibile fare una risonanza subito o magari un TAC.
Ma è abbastanza facile adesso.
Però ci sono dei casi magari in cui il pilota ha avuto una caduta senza esiti apparentemente grossi, però bisogna semplicemente guardare negli occhi e cercare di capire il suo stato d'animo, decidere sulla base di quello?
Credo che guardare negli occhi è come la risonanza e l'attack, se un medico è molto bravo.
It's my opinion that if a doctor is worth his salt, then a close examination of the eyes will in itself be as good as a CAT scan and give you a lot of the information that you're looking for.
Yeah, agree.
Esistono delle commissioni mediche dopo le cadute che decidono se il pilota può correre o no, e quindi sono molto attente queste commissioni. Esiste un medical director che insieme ai medici del Gran Premio, cioè del paese in cui si svolge il Gran Premio, decidono se dopo un infortunio il pilota è idoneo o no a correre. Fortunatamente non spetta a me chiederglielo, decidere questo, perché io deciderei sempre in base a quello che mi chiede il pilota, quindi non sarei molto obiettivo dal punto di vista medico.
Okay,
baderei sulle sogni.
Okay, fortunately for the rider, I'm not the person who's actually deciding whether or not he should return to the track. That's a decision which is a collective one. It's taken by the medical commissions that oversee the races. It's a decision that is largely in the hands of the medical director of the GP in the country where it's being raced.
So if it were my decision personally, I would always probably second the rider's wishes. If he wants to race, I personally would let him do so every time. So perhaps it's in their interest that I'm not the one with all the decisional capability.
I like that.
I just prefer to let them follow their dreams.
Yeah. So I, in just a generalized way, I know that Dr. Costa, you are a huge fan of motorsport and motorcycle road racing. And you kind of, I guess you kind of vicariously get to experience the racing through the piloti, as you say. It's easy to think that the racers enjoy the spotlight. That's why they're willing to take the risk. But clearly the sports like mountain climbing, very personal, even lonely, and that entails greatness risk nonetheless. What do you think drives these people to climb higher, ride faster, take crazy risks?
Well, okay, so you mean all of the people together, the mountain climbers, the just let's say people who do dangerous sports in general?
Exactly.
Okay. Si potrebbe dire che per i piloti, che lei evidentemente è un amante di tutti i motorsport e il mondo della velocità, però ci sono anche tanti altri sport dove i protagonisti non sono in un teatro della velocità o non sono sotto i riflettori delle telecamere, magari persone che si arrampicano sulle vette delle montagne e rischiano ugualmente anche nella solitudine la loro vita. Quindi secondo lei, guardando tutte le persone, non solo i motociclisti, ma tutte le persone che si sentono spinti verso il rischio, si sentono obbligati da se stessi di spingersi verso un limite personale, qual è la persona, la cosa secondo lei che li spinge a fare tutto ciò? One word rather, death. Is
abbattere e giocare a scacchi con la moto per portargli via tempo.
They fear death and as the thief of time. Time is all they have as mortals, really, and that time is best spent living as intensely as possible rather than fearing the eventual day of death.
Conquista che sia personale, non conosciuta o anche sotto i riflettori nello sport, la vittoria è sempre la vittoria sulla morte, non è il premio, non è la classifica, ma profondamente è una grande vittoria dell'anima sulla morte.
Any sport, the real victory is not the... It could be anything. It could be persons diving down to the deepest reaches of the ocean. It might be somebody climbing Everest. It could be somebody doing motorsports. But I would say that their motivation is certainly not the money or a large cup to put on display for friends at home or anything like that. It's really a heightened awareness of the presence of death, and every victory that any sportsman achieves, it is a victory over death.
I will agree with that 100%, and certainly for
100%. Okay, well, he's glad that you agree with him.
just from my own personal experience, and the reason that I jumped out of planes, raced motorcycles, the same thing.
Yeah. Lui ha fatto tante cose, si è buttato dagli aeroplani, cioè anche lui ha fatto corse con le motociclette e lui concorda esattamente.
E dice che l'ultima grande tragedia, quella di Marco Simoncelli, ha dimostrato l'autenticità della morte, di farlo diventare immortale per sempre, perché è vivo nel cuore di tutti.
And I believe that if we look at the case of Marco Simoncelli's recent death, it's really an example of how death can actually bring you to something of an eternal life. Like through death, he's really been absorbed into everybody's heart and become a part of every single one of us.
And I agree. And you know that the death of Marco, as tragic as it was, it was one of those crashes that you can never sort of understand and actually anticipate. As same thing with Shoya Tomasawa the prior year. How does the doctor and the clinica deal with events of this magnitude?
Naturalmente quello è stato un incidente della dinamica molto difficile da spiegare o da decifrare, è una cosa che nessuno poteva prevedere.
Ma infatti sto scrivendo un libro su questo, quando è pronto glielo facciamo sapere. È tradotto in inglese, lo stai traducendo tu.
Ok, finisco un attimo le domande, che parlavo anche di Tomo Saulo. La sua domanda è questo, che quando succede una cosa così, dentro la clinica mobile, dentro la squadra della clinica mobile, come si affronta questo momento?
Con il dolore.
As regards as how we face an event like this, really there is no way for it to be faced with any planned way at all. What we feel is what everybody feels. We're really overcome by grief. And as regards the tragic events surrounding Marco Simoncelli, well, at the moment I'm writing another book, and a consistent part of that book is going to be dedicated to Marco Simoncelli. And as soon as we have a draft of that, which I'm translating, so then we'll have it over to you as soon as possible.
Great, thank you. Tomozawa, a similar incident. Thoughts on that?
I suoi pensieri sull'incidente che è capitato a Tomozawa. C'è stato un incidente da un altro corridore l'anno scorso, Tomozawa.
Sì, Tomozawa.
Sì.
Anche lui stava sorridendo in quel momento quando è stato investito da due incolpevoli compagni. E anche Tomozawa nel mio libro, ed è l'autunno, il capitolo di Tomozawa è l'autunno di Soya Tomozawa, ed è lì in quel libro che spiego tutto quello che è il mio tormento, le mie emozioni, come nel libro di Marco, che è La vittoria di Marco, dove appunto spiego che il dolore che provo per questi piloti si trasforma magicamente, le lettere che compongono il dolore si trasformano in qualcosa di incredibile, perché mi fanno capire che la loro impressa di vivere, che è la cosa più bella in questa vita, che è un paradiso qui nella bruna terra rispetto a quello che c'è in paradiso celeste nel cielo.
Okay, so yeah, with regard to Tomozawa, I'm actually talk about him in the book, the forthcoming book. The section about Tomozawa is entitled Tomozawa's Autumn. The thing that I as regards to Tomozawa's accident and any accident that happens with tragic consequences, the thing that always surprises me personally is how my initial emotion, the one of grief, is gradually transformed into something which I would call a recognition of the intensity with which they've lived their lives. The fact that the intensity, the joy that they feel and must have felt, even at the time of racing in their very last moments, was a joy that very few of us actually get to experience in what may be long lives, but often perhaps grey and banal lives. So I kind of my thoughts on Tomozawa is that when he was involved in the accident and run over by two blameless companions, that he was living life on high, and in his heart he was smiling.
Right. And please tell the doctor that I can, through even my limited understanding of Italian, understand the poetry in which he said that.
Anche attraverso le sue limitate conoscenze della lingua italiana, ha detto comunque che riconosce la poesia con cui dice queste parole.
Ah, nel libro ci sarà tutta la mia poesia.
Okay.
Per quello che vale.
There will be a lot more poetry in the book for what it's worth.
Come all'essere umano.
One final question that I will let you go, and I will thank you gentlemen both for your time.
Una domanda.
Because I know, and I've been to the Clinica facilities at Indianapolis, at Laguna Seca, I've had friends that have been at them overseas. And I know that you usually watch on TV monitors from the facilities because you need to be there. Has there ever been one incident you just kind of felt the most helpless at from an immediate standpoint? You saw something on the monitors and you're like, wow, we need to be there right now. We can't be.
Ok, io naturalmente ho guardato tante gare, so che anche ho avuto l'opportunità di venire a trovarvi alla clinica ad Indianapolis, so che voi guardate la gara sui monitor, chiedo questo, c'è mai stato un incidente che guardandolo sui monitor vi ha fatto venire la consapevolezza istantanea che questo è incredibilmente grave, che dobbiamo fare qualcosa subito, pur sapendo che forse l'esito dell'incidente era già forse senza speranza?
Tonizawa e Marco
Sinicelli. Two accidents in particular. Tomizawa and Marco Simoncelli, obviously, and also
Gilles Villeneuve.
Okay.
Sure. Maybe Peter Lenz as well.
Peter Lenz. Yeah. Peter Lenz.
Yeah. All right. Well, I do want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking the time. Dr. Costa, certainly, and I hope to see you at Laguna or Indianapolis this year, or probably at the Isle of Man. And Steve, well done on the translation for the book, and thank you for that from myself and the rest of the Motopod fans. And you gentlemen have a great evening.
Okay, just a second, Jim. La ringrazio tantissimo per il suo tempo, per la sua disponibilità. Spero di vederla al più presto a Laguna o Indianapolis.
Sì. E ringrazio. Penso di esserci.
Okay, he's pretty sure he'll be there at Indianapolis. Yes.
Mi piace l'America.
He enjoys every trip to America.
Io so che gli americani tutto quello che è italiano piace.
And I know that a lot of Italians go crazy for everything that's Italian, so it's a good match.
All right. Well, again, thanks. Thank you both. And Steve, send me an email when you get a chance. I am curious more about your background.
Okay. I'll do that. Definitely. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Great evening.
Bye-bye.
So many thanks to both Steve, the interpreter, and to Dr. Costa of the Clinica Mobile. I wasn't kidding when I said in the beginning of that interview that those people provide what is essentially, and this comes from my racing background, Jules, essentially is the thing that will allow you to push your limits at the track. And so massive, massive respect. And thank you so much, Dr. Costa, for the opportunity to have a talk with you for the show.
It was an excellent interview, and thank you very much for going out there and getting that one, Jim. That was a tough one. We've been trying to get him on the show for a long, long time.
Yeah, so very, very, very cool. Should we try and do a giveaway, Jules?
Why not?
Okay, so I need to preface this. So the official camera of AMA Pro Road Racing and the title sponsor of AMA GoPro Daytona Sport Bike Class. Was that good? That being, we have a GoPro HD Hero 2 giveaway this evening, gentlemen and ladies, and anybody is eligible. Jules, you have the question. I think you should throw it out there. It's all about when you get this edited and put out there, but we're gonna have a bit of a roundtable. So let's see what we can do.
So first of all, the rules. So Jim hooked us up with another giveaway. We did the one last year. This is the HD2, which is their newest version. It's slightly more wide angle and has like better low light and all that kind of stuff. It's
very cool.
It's a big step up. A friend of mine just got one. Was showing it to me. Anyway, the rules are: I'm going to ask you a question. It's not super hard. We expect to get some answers, so we're going to have a drawing. But you have to turn in your answers by Monday, January 23rd. And the winner will be announced, drawn, and announced during show number 303. So next week, we're not gonna announce the winners yet. So you'll have basically a little bit over a week and a half to get us an answer to this question. The question is, who was the last Australian, other than Casey Stoner, to lead a MotoGP race? That means by leading a MotoGP race, that means that they were officially leading a lap at the end of a lap during a MotoGP race. All you have to do is name the rider. But if you also know the year and the round during which this happened, you get extra kudos, but you don't get like an extra.
you don't end up on the top of the virtual hat.
No,
but
no, the hat stays the same. We have to keep that legal. So just name the rider. Then we'll have the drawing on in show 303, and some lucky some lucky bastard is going to walk away with an HD2.
Yeah, very, very cool of GoPro. This is, as you well know, Jules, they were very happy to provide this again to the Motopod fans. And I think very cool stuff. A neat company when it comes to sort of getting motorsports.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Well, another massive show just to kick off the year. We did have, obviously, Dakar's underway, and I have to say, today was the first day that I actually watched the footage from it, because the first time I went to look on January 1st, the first time I went to look for news on Dakar, it was very bad news, because we lost a rider right off the bat on the first round, which is very strange, because the first round is usually almost like a parade thing with a couple of, you know...
Right.
So unfortunately, there was a fatality, and I actually really had a tough time getting interested again. But
totally.
But the racing has been really close between the same old guys, you know.
Kokoma, Dupre.
Yeah. So I need to start following it again, and we'll give this proper coverage maybe in the next show.
True, I think we should, because in a way, Dakar is kind of our. Our winter,
yeah, our off season,
yeah, our
entertainment.
Winter
absolutely.
All right, well, Jules, I think we probably worn these folks out yet once again, have we not?
I haven't heard any complaints last time, so
no. I remember when people were like, "Oh, it's over half an hour." Yeah.
Righteous.
Sorry. Ain't going to be that way, folks. I got more interviews lined up for the coming future. And once again, thank you so much for listening. You can catch us on Facebook, facebook.com/motopod, obviously at motopodcast.com, and write in to us at motopodcast@motopodcast.com. And we'd love to hear from you.
Cool. All right. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Should I make the noise?
Sure.
Yes, Ellie brought me a beer.
That's awesome.
I know.
What a
keeper.
Are
you kidding me?
She's awesome.